Chapter 30. As Hugh crossed the parking lot in front of East Cooper Hospital, I watched him from a window in the third floor waiting room where Kat and I had been ensconced since dawn. Even from up here, I could see that his face was tanned, and I knew he'd been tilling up the backyard again. When confronted with loss, Hugh got out the old hand tiller that had belonged to his father and exhausted himself with physical labor, plowing up huge stretches of the yard. Sometimes he wouldn't even get around to planting anything. The point seemed to be just ripping up the ground. After his father died, I'd watched him plow with such sorrow and drivenness, stoically propelling himself into the early summer darkness, that I could not bear to watch. He had rendered much of the 2 acres around the house a bare, exposed ground of fresh wounds. I'd once seen him pick up a handful of the upturned dirt and, closing his eyes, smell it. I'd called him at 6 this morning. It had been dawn by then, but the forbidding darkness and quiet that had floated through the hospital all night had not yet lifted. Dialing the number, I'd felt overwhelmed by the shrouded, deft way Mother had been laying siege to herself. I was defeated, to tell the truth. I knew that Hugh would understand how I felt, the exact contours of every feeling. I would not have to explain anything. When I heard his voice, I started to cry. The tears I squashed on the ferry. "I have to commit her," I'd said, struggling for composure. The surgeon on call who'd repaired Mother's hand had made that clear enough. "I suggest this time you get a psychiatrist in to see her and start commitment papers," he'd said kindly enough, but with emphasis on this time. "Do you want me to come?" Hugh asked.
"I can't do this alone," I told him. "Kat's here, but yes, please. Could you come?"
He'd gotten there in record time. I looked at the clock on the wall. It was just past 1 p.m. He was wearing a knit sport shirt, the terracotta one I liked so much, and crisp khaki pants with his tasseled loafers. He looked well, the same handsome, golden look about him, and his hair was cut shorter than I'd seen it in years. I, on the other hand, looked like one of those people you see on the television news who shuffle around in the aftermath of some natural disaster. My hair needed washing, my teeth needed brushing, and my eyes had puffy, bruised-looking smudges underneath from lack of sleep. I wore the gray warm-up pants and white T-shirt I'd slept in. I'd had to scrub Mother's blood off them in the visitor's bathroom. Most embarrassing of all, I had no shoes. How could I have left without shoes? I'd been startled on the ferry when I saw that my feet were bare. One of the nurses had given me a cheap pair of terrycloth slippers sealed in a plastic bag. The worst part of the night had been waiting to hear if Mother would be okay. Physically, I should say. At that point, I don't think either Kat or I had a lot of hope for her mentally. They'd let us in to see her while she was still in the recovery room. We'd held on to the bed rail, staring down at her face, which was the color of oatmeal. A pale green oxygen tube had gurgled under her nose, and blood was dripping thick as resin into her arm from a plastic bag over her head. Reaching down under the sheet, I'd picked up her good hand and squeezed it.
"It's me, Mother. It's Jessie."
After several attempts, she'd cracked open her eyes and tried to focus on me, parting and closing her lips, repeatedly without making a sound, priming the words from what I imagined to be a contaminated well deep inside her.
"Don't throw it away," she mumbled,
her tone barely audible. I bent over her.
"What are you saying? Throw what away?"
A nurse making marks on a clipboard nearby looked up.
"She's been saying that since she started waking."
I bent down where I could smell the noxious odor of the anesthetic from her mouth.
"Throw what away?" I repeated.
"My finger," she said.
and the nurse stopped writing and stared at me with her mouth formed into a small, pinched circle. "Where is your finger?" I asked. "I looked for it." "In a bowl, in the refrigerator," she said, her eyes already closed.
I'd called Mike at 10 a.m., 7 in California. Waiting for him to pick up, I'd felt like his little sister again, needing him to come and take care of things. Once, as children, we'd run the bateau aground on a mudflat, and trying to help push us off, I'd fallen over the side up to my waist in mud. In places, the mud could suck you down like jungle quicksand, and I'd flailed around hysterically as he'd hauled me out. That's what I wanted now. Mike to reach down and lift me out of this. When he answered, I told him everything, and that I was going to have to commit Mother. He responded that I should keep him informed. Not, "I'll get the next plane," the way Hugh had said, only that impotent token of concern. I felt for a moment like I was going under.
"Oh," I said.
"I'm sorry I'm not there to help, Jess. I'll come when I can. It's just that now is not good." "When is it ever good?" "Not ever," he responded. "I wish I were more like you, able to face things better. You always dealt with it better than I did." We never talked about the bedroom drawer we'd rummaged through as children, reading the clipping about our father's death, the strange, sad spiral Mother's life had taken, the mounting religious obsessions we'd witnessed with confusion. We both knew he'd run away from the island the same as I had, but he'd gone farther, and not just in miles. He'd washed his hands of it. "I found his pipe," I said abruptly, feeling furious at his desertion. He was silent. I pictured the news poised over his head, guillotine style, waiting to drop the way it had with me, the sudden slice of recognition that a crucial piece of one's past has been a lie. "But," he said, and, bogging down, started again, "but that's what caused the fire."
"Apparently not."
I was suddenly fatigued in the tiniest creases of my body, between my fingers, behind my ears, in the corners of my mouth. "God, it never ends, does it?" He sounded so damaged saying it that my anger began to dissolve. I knew then he would never come back and face all of this. He wasn't able. "Do you remember Father Dominic?" I asked. "The monk who always wore the straw hat?"
"How could I forget?"
"Do you think there could have been something between him and Mother?" He actually laughed.
"You can't be serious. You mean, an affair? You think that's the reason she's cut off her fingers? To pay her pound of flesh for it?"
"I don't know, but there's some kind of history between them."
"Jess, come on."
"Don't laugh at this, Mike. I don't think I can take that right now." My voice rose. "You're not here. You don't see what I see. Believe me, there are more outrageous things than that in her life."
"You're right. Sorry," he said. He let go of his breath, let it melt into the phone. "I only saw them together once. I went over to the monastery to ask Mom if she'd let me go out with Shem on the trawler. I was around 15, I think, and I found her and Father Dominic in the kitchen, fighting."
"About what? You remember?"
"It was about the mermaid chair. Father Dominic was trying to get her to go sit in it, and she was furious for some reason. He told her twice, 'You have to make your peace with it.' It didn't make sense to me. But for a long time after that, I wondered about it. All I can tell you is that if the two of them had an affair, which, honestly, I can't begin to conceive, they didn't seem remotely amicable at that point."
When we hung up, I felt more confused than when I'd called, but at least he knew now about Mother, and I knew about him, that part of him would always be lost to me.
I felt comforted, though, that we were at least linked the way we'd been as children, not partners in conquering the island, which had been our carefree alliance before Father died, but partners in survival, surviving Mother. Outside, in the parking lot, Hugh was approaching the hospital entrance. I watched him pause on the sidewalk, looking down as if studying the spidery cracks in the cement. He seemed to be preparing himself. For me, no doubt. It was a moment of such private vulnerability that I stepped back from the window. I darted a glance toward Kat, who sat across the room, squeezing the bridge of her nose. Mother's behavior seemed to have had a sobering effect on her. I'd never seen her so quiet. Earlier, beside the bed in the recovery room, I'd watched Kat close her eyes and tighten both her fists, as if swearing a private oath to herself. Or at least that's how I read it. "He's here," I said to her, trying to sound casual. I had a skittish feeling in my stomach. This would be the first time I'd seen him since making love with Wit. I had the irrational feeling that the knowledge was somehow posted all over me for him to read, like scarlet A's popping out like freckles in the sun. Crossing the bay last night, jerked out of my illusory storm tent and acutely aware of my ability to twist things to my liking, I'd kept my shock confined to Mother. But now, seeing Hugh, it was like coming upon my world of deceit, seeing it diagrammed like a map with a pointing arrow. You are here. Here. A place where the heart and its cravings obliterate everything. Conscience, the will of the mind, the careful plating together of lives. The ache in my stomach was the knot of blame. I know that. Hugh had staked his life on me and lost. But there was defiance coiled in the feeling as well. What I'd felt, what I'd done, it wasn't only some unstoppable, erotic urge pent up too long. Not just lust and libido and overactive sex organs. That wouldn't be fair. The heart was an organ too, wasn't it? It had been so easy to dismiss the heart before. A little feeling factory you could shut down if necessary. How unfair. The feelings that ripped through it had power and force, perhaps at times the consent of the soul. I'd felt it myself, the way my soul had raised its hand to consecrate what was happening to me. "Do you have a comb?" I asked Kat. "And lipstick?" I'd not brought a purse, either. She handed me a tube and a small brush, lifting her eyebrows. "I look like shit," I told her. "I don't want him to think I'm so lost without him I've gone to pot."
"Good luck with that," she said, but smiling at me.
When he stepped into the waiting room, he looked at me, then away. I thought suddenly of Wit and felt my stomach turn over, the need to breathe, to paddle to the island in the marsh, a million miles from the world and go down into the cool, dark water. All three of us, even Kat, struggled as we waded through the initial greetings, the "How have you beens?" Part of me didn't want to know how he'd been, for fear my knees would buckle. And part of me felt that if he described every ounce of pain and trauma I'd inflicted on him, it was the least I deserved. For a good 3 or 4 minutes, Hugh and I seemed to be calibrating an emotional thermostat, tapping it up and down, acting too friendly, then too reserved. It wasn't until the focus turned to Mother that we began to get comfortable in the room together. Which is saying a lot, considering how wretched that situation was. We sat in padded wooden chairs near the window, around a coffee table covered in old magazines, some going back to 1982. I was freshly knowledgeable about everything from Sandra Day O'Connor's appointment to the Supreme Court to Michael Jackson's glove. Hugh was wearing a thin bracelet of what looked like braided embroidery thread around his right wrist, blue, tan, and black, which floored me because Hugh hated to wear any sort of jewelry except his wedding ring. That, I noticed, was still on his left hand. He saw me staring at the bracelet. It's from Dee, he said. She made it herself. I believe she called it a friendship bracelet. He lifted it up with abashed amusement, shrugging at the oddity of such a thing's being there, his daughters wanting to seal their friendship. I'm under orders not to take it off. I'm told there would be terrible consequences if... The absurdity of worrying about terrible consequences, given the fact they'd already happened, caused him to stop mid-sentence and lower his arm. What he didn't know was that Dee had made one of these bracelets for her high school friend, Heather Morgan, as a way to comfort her after she'd been dumped. It had been an act of sisterly solidarity. Dee would never have made one of those for Hugh unless she knew about us. Had he told her? How nice that she made it for you, I said. What was the occasion? He looked uncomfortable.
April 10th.
His birthday. I'd forgotten. But even if I'd remembered, I doubted I would have called, considering. Happy birthday, I offered.
I missed our follies this year, he said. Maybe next year.
He settled the full force of his gaze on me. It was laden with the unspoken question of next year.
Follies? Kat said. Now that sounds fascinating.
We need to talk about Mother, I said with obvious discomfort, such a transparent evasion tactic that he smiled slightly. I glanced at the blank commitment papers lying in the empty chair next to mine. They carried the presence of a full-blooded person sitting there, a dismal, menacing person needing attention. Hugh reached over and picked them up. There were small band-aids on the insides of both his thumbs, tiller blisters, proof he'd been trying to plow through. I watched as he skimmed the pages, staring at his hands. For a strange second, it seemed my whole marriage was visible in them. In the tufts of hair near his wrists, the lines on his palms, his fingers filled with memories of touching me. The mystery of what held people together was right there.
Okay, he said, lowering the papers to his lap. Let's talk about her.
I started at the beginning. The night I arrived on the island, I found Mother burying her finger beside St. Sinara's statue. You remember me telling you about that? Hugh nodded. I asked her why she'd cut it off, and she started to tell me, you know, the way you say something before you remember it's a secret. She mentioned Dad's name and Father Dominic's, and then, realizing what she'd said, stopped and wouldn't go on. So obviously Dominic is involved somehow. I glanced at Kat. Of course, Kat disagrees with me. She didn't defend herself. In part, I'd said it just to see if she might. She merely stared back at me, crossing and uncrossing her legs.
Did you ask this Father Dominic about it? Hugh said.
Yes, and he suggested to me that some things are better off left secret. Hugh was leaning forward, his hands clasped between his knees.
Okay, forget Dominic for the moment. Why do you think she's cutting off her fingers? You've been with her for over 2 months. What's your gut say?
My gut. I was momentarily speechless. Hugh was asking me for a gut feeling, and on something about which he was the expert. Before, he'd always brusquely given me his clinical opinion, very textbook, right out of the DSM-3, and dismissed what I'd thought. I have a feeling it goes back to something she thinks she's done, I said, measuring my words, wanting so much to say it right. Something having to do with my father, and it's so awful it has driven her crazy. Literally. I believe that her insane need to butcher herself is a way of doing penance. She's trying to atone. I remember how Kat looked away and shook her head slightly, like people do when they're disbelieving. I was determined to convince her as much as Hugh. I quoted the scripture that says if your right hand offends you, it's better to cut it off than to have your whole body cast into hell.
Do you have any idea what sin Nell is trying to expunge? Hugh asked. Kat brought her hand to her forehead and rubbed a patch of redness in her skin. I saw that her eyes looked wide and, yes, scared. I started to answer that it had occurred to me more than once that Mother and Dominic might have had an affair, but I caught myself. There was no way I could say that. It was too close to my own truth. And what evidence did I have, anyway? How Dominic had asked my mother if she would ever forgive them? That he'd written an un-monk-like paragraph in his little booklet suggesting that erotic love was every bit as spiritual as divine love? That Saint Eudoria, whom Mother may have been emulating, was a prostitute? I shrugged. I don't know, but penance is only part of it. I think she believes she can bring about some kind of redemption by doing this.
What do you mean, redemption? Kat asked.
I told them about the two books Mother had gotten out of the monastery library. The stories of Saint Eudoria, who cut off her finger and planted it in a field, and Sedna, whose 10 severed fingers fell into the ocean and turned into the first sea creatures. As I talked, I kept looking at Hugh to see if he was taking what I said with a grain of salt, or whether he thought it really had merit. I didn't want to care what he thought, but I did. I wanted him to say, "Yes, yes, you have seen through to the truth. You have done this for your mother." "That's what I mean about redemption," I said. "I think all this dismembering she's doing is really about her need to grow something or make a new world, to remember herself back in a new way." Dismembering and remembering. The idea had only just occurred to me that moment.
"Interesting," Hugh said. And when I rolled my eyes, thinking he'd dismissed me, he shook his head.
"No, I mean, it is interesting, more than interesting." He offered me a sad, disappointed smile.
"I used to say that, didn't I? As a way of glossing over what you said."
Kat got up and wandered to the other side of the room, where she rummaged purposelessly through her purse. "We both did things," I told him.
"I'm sorry," he said.
I didn't know what to say. He wanted me to reach out to him, to say, "Yes, next year we'll have the Follies. I've made a vast mistake. I want to come home." And I couldn't. I had thought our life together was vouchsafed. It was one of those unpremeditated facts I'd live with every single day, like the sun going through its motions, coming and going, an automaton. Like the stars fixed in the Milky Way. Who questions these things? They just are. I'd thought we would be buried together, side by side, in a nice cemetery in Atlanta. Or that our cremated remains would sit in matching urns in Dee's house until she found it in herself to go out and scatter them. Once I'd imagined her hauling the urns all the way to Egret Island and tossing handfuls of us in the air on Boneyard Beach. I'd picture the wind whipping us together in a blizzard of indistinguishable particles, Hugh and me flying to the sky, returning to the earth together. And Dee walking away with bits of us in her hair. What was the mysterious and enduring thing that had made me so certain of us for so long? Where had it gone? I looked at his hands. The silence was terrible. He ended it himself.
"If you're right about Nell, Jesse, and you really could be, then maybe the key is simply remembering, recalling the past in a way that allows her to face it. That can be very healing sometimes."
He placed the commitment papers back on the empty chair.
"Are you going to sign?"
When I scrawled my name, Kat held her head in her hands and didn't look at me. Hugh came back to Egret Island with me that evening, taking his suitcase into Mike's old room while I went straight to the bathroom and filled the tub with steaming water. Kat had insisted on staying overnight at the hospital, that I be the one to go home.
Tomorrow, Mother would be transported to the psychiatric unit at the Medical University of South Carolina in Charleston. And Hugh had agreed to be there when I checked her in and met with the psychiatrist. I felt grateful to him. I slid down into the water, going all the way under, and lay as still as I could. So motionless, I began to hear my heart resounding through the water. I held my breath and thought of those World War II movies where the submarine hides on the bottom of the ocean, shut down except for the ping, ping of the sonar, everyone holding his breath, waiting to see if the Japanese would hear it. I felt like that, as if my heart might give me away.
"Maybe next year," Hugh had said. The words made my chest start to hurt. The Follies, the psychiatric Follies, as we facetiously called them, were Hugh's favorite birthday present. In some ways, I think they were the highlight of his year. I'd overheard Dee trying to describe the Follies once to Heather.
"See, Mom and I put on a show for my dad. We make up a song about his work, about hypnotizing somebody and not being able to wake them up, or having an Oedipus complex, something like that."
Heather had screwed up her nose. "Your family's weird."
"I know,"
Dee had said, as if this were a great big compliment. Surfacing, I lay in the tub with the water just under my nostrils and felt the wrench of knowing that even though Dee was away at college this year, she'd probably remember the Follies, but hadn't mentioned them to me when we'd talked, for reasons I was afraid to know. Hugh had told her about us. I was sure of it. And yet she'd said nothing. Dee had been the one who'd started the Follies, though I'd been her inspiration, I guess you'd say. It began when I'd gotten my hair cut at a salon over in Buckhead. There had been a bowl of Godiva chocolates at the entrance, and standing beside it, I'd fidgeted with my watch, an inexpensive Timex with an expandable band. I did that sometimes, sliding it on and off my wrist, the way someone twirls her hair or taps a pencil. Later, when I left, I'd reached for a chocolate, and there it was. My watch was in the candy bowl. "Isn't that odd?" I'd said at dinner that night, relating the incident to Hugh and Dee, only making conversation, but Hugh had perked right up.
"It's a Freudian slip," he said.
"What's that?"
asked Dee, only 13 then.
"It's when you say or do something without being aware of it," Hugh told her. "Something that's got a hidden meaning."
He leaned forward and I saw it coming, the god-awful Freudian slip joke.
"Like when you say one thing and mean a mother," he said.
"That's funny," Dee said. "But what did it mean when Mom took off her watch like that?"
He looked at me, and I felt momentarily like a lab rat. Pointing his fork in my direction, he said, "She wanted to remove herself from the constraints of time. It's a classic fear of death."
"Oh, please," I said.
"You know what I think," said Dee,
and Hugh and I sat up, expecting something precocious.
"I think Mom just left her watch in the candy bowl."
Dee and I burst into conspiratorial laughter. It had escalated from there. Fear of death became FOD, FOD, and we teased him without mercy. That year, Dee wrote a farcical song about FOD and enlisted me to sing it with her on his birthday to the tune of Pop Goes the Weasel. And so began the psychiatric Follies. No one loved them more than Hugh. Around March, he would start bugging the hell out of us to reveal the theme. Last year, Dee had written an opus to her own original tune called Penis Envy, the Musical. "Dear Dr. Freud, we are overjoyed to declare null and void your penis envy fraud. Do you really think we peg our hope between your legs? Must your beloved male part be the desire of our heart? A penis? Are you serious? A woman would be delirious. Just between us, there's more to life than a penis. I say with no trace of mirth, has Dr. Freud given birth? Could we just assume you're pining for a womb?"
We performed it in the living room, pregnant with sofa pillows that were stuffed under our shirts, doing choreographed steps and gestures worthy of the Supremes. An hour later, Hugh was still laughing. I'd felt then there was so much glue between us that nothing could splinter it. Now, in the little bathroom, I rubbed the bar of soap over my arms and studied the square pink tiles on the wall. Mike had hated sharing what he'd called the girly bathroom. The same pale pink organdy curtains hung in the small window, dingy now to the point of appearing orange. I shampooed my hair, scrubbed my skin. When I'd signed the commitment papers, I'd had to write the date, April 17th. It had made me think of Wit. The first year, we'll celebrate our anniversary monthly on the 17th. I told him. I wished I could call him. I knew that earlier today, even though it was Sunday, he would have been at the rookery. I pictured him arriving at the dock, spotting the red canoe and glancing around for me. I wondered if he'd waited a while for me to show up before setting out, whether he'd sat on the bank where he'd washed my feet and listened for the quiet sound of my paddle. Perhaps by vespers, before the rule had folded them all back into wordless silence till the morning, the news about Nell had spread across the island and spilled over the Brick Abbey wall. Maybe he knew why I hadn't come to him. I heard Hugh's footsteps pacing the hallway, back and forth. When they stopped, I could tell he was just outside the door. I looked around to see if I'd locked it, though I was sure Hugh would never come in without knocking. The latch, an old-fashioned hook and eye, was unfastened. I waited. Held my breath. Ping. 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 Finally, he moved away. What had caused him to tread up and down the hallway like that? When I came out of the bathroom, I wore Mother's blue bathrobe, my hair wet, combed back and slicked down like enamel. It was when the cool air hit my face that I remembered. I'd propped my canvases across the bed, the dresser, and the floor in Mike's room, ostensibly for storage, but I would go in there at times and stare at my work. It was like standing in a gallery inside myself, gazing at the deep, dark marvels. My 13 diving women, their wild, sensual bodies grandly nude. I thought of Hugh in there, studying them, examining the cast-off pieces of their lives that I'd painted floating to the surface. The kitchen spatulas, the apple peels, the wedding rings, the geese. Oh, God, the kissing geese, our kissing geese. Frozen in place outside the bathroom door, I realized that even the colored pencil sketch I'd made back in February was in there, the one I'd hidden for weeks behind the lighthouse picture over the mantel. He would see my enraptured couple clinging to each other's bodies, encircled by the woman's exceedingly long hair. Sometimes when I'd looked at the picture, all I could see was her hair, and I'd remember Dee teasing me, calling my attic studio Rapunzel's Tower, wanting to know when I was going to let my hair down. Hugh had always grimaced at that, even defended me to her, sometimes snappishly. "Your mother isn't locked in a tower, Dee," he said. "Now stop it." Maybe he'd thought it was a reflection on him. Or maybe, somewhere inside, he'd known it was true and was afraid of it. None of us ever mentioned the rest of the tale, how Rapunzel did finally let down her hair for the prince and escaped. Hugh Sullivan was the most astute man on earth. I began to feel a dilating pressure in my chest. I walked to Mike's room and paused in the doorway. Inside, it was dim, lit by one small table lamp with a low-wattage bulb. Hugh was staring at my underwater couple. Lovers in the blue sea, I called them, after Chagall's lovers in the red sky. His back was to me. His hands were in his pockets. He turned around, parting this night from all other nights, letting his eyes, bruised and disbelieving,
come slowly to my face, and I could feel the air around us blaze up with a terrible thing that was about to happen. "Who is he?" he asked.
Chapter 31 Wit. He sat in the music listening room on a ladder-back chair, staring at the television set, which was perched on a table conspicuously covered with an old altar cloth. It was the top of the seventh of a Braves doubleheader on TBS. Tom Glavine had just struck out. Wit took his pencil and traced a small K on the scorecard he'd drawn in the back of his journal. There was something about watching baseball that took him completely out of himself. It worked on him better than meditation. He could never meditate more than 2 minutes without chasing one thought after another or becoming so self-conscious it defeated the whole purpose. But he could sit in front of a game with absolute absorption. He lost himself in the tension of the play, the strategy, the intricacies of scoring, all the diagrams, symbols, and numbers. He would never have been able to explain to Father Sebastian or any of the others why it was a refuge for him. He just knew he felt exempt sitting here, from the monastery, from himself. Before Vespers, the abbot had announced Nell's latest tragedy, as he now delicately referred to her amputations, asking the monks to pray for her, their beloved cook and friend. Wit had stood in choir, staring stoically ahead, aware of Dominic turning to look at him. He'd thought then how he'd spent all afternoon waiting for Jesse in the rookery to no avail, only to come back and find Dominic pacing the porch of the cottage. He'd been the one to give Wit the news, even the part about Jesse's husband coming from Atlanta to be with her. He delivered that portion with scrupulous concern. Wit had not had the presence of mind to ask Dominic until later how he'd come to know all this, when he discovered that Hepzibah Postel, the Gullah woman, had come to the monastery and explained everything to Dominic. Why would Hepzibah come to Dominic, of all people? All through Vespers, Wit had yearned to come here and turn on the doubleheader and disappear into the game. He'd burst out of his choir stall like a racehorse so he could get the game on before the other monks came herding in for community time. They inevitably spent it watching the evening news. It mostly boiled down to watching Tom Brokaw announcing Reagan's latest social cutbacks. The last time he'd come in here, they had been watching a segment on how to dress for success, something about designer suits by Perry Ellis and Calvin Klein, and the monks had sat there with such rapt attention he'd wanted to stand up and shout, "But you're wearing robes!" The point of their robes was the exact opposite of dressing for success. Surely they saw that. He'd gotten up and left. On weekends, Brother Fabian would put one of the monastery's scratchy old 33 1/3 RPM records on the stereo, usually Wagner's The Ring of the Nibelung. He would turn the volume so loud the air would tremble with the bass. Tonight, when the monks had arrived to find that Wit had commandeered the TV set and filled it with the announcer's play-by-play, they'd complained to Father Sebastian, who had sovereign jurisdiction over the room. Sebastian had scrutinized Wit before telling the men to stop whining. It wouldn't kill them to miss the news once in a blue moon. They had all left and gone back to their rooms to wait for Compline, except for Dominic and Sebastian. He wanted to be angry at them, to use this as just more justification for leaving, but the sight of the monks shuffling off in various degrees of huff was no different, really, from his own arrogant refusal to be in here when they watched Brokaw or listened to Siegfried and Brunhilde. It reminded him suddenly of the whole point of existing here with these curmudgeonly old men, that somewhere on the face of the earth there needed to be people bound together with irrevocable stamina, figuring out a way to live with one another. He'd come here with such idiotic notions, expecting a slight variation on utopia, everybody loving everybody else, returning good for evil, turning the other cheek left and right. Monks, it had turned out,
were no more perfect than any other group of people. He'd gradually realized with a kind of wonder that they'd been picked for a hidden but noble experiment. To see if people might actually be able to live in genuine relatedness. To see if perhaps God had made a mistake by creating the human species. He seemed to think constantly these days about what it meant to be at the monastery, to be part of it. The whole outrageous thing. He thought equally about Jessie, what it meant to love her, to be part of her. That was outrageous too. What he'd not thought about was her husband. A real person. A man who'd rushed here to be with his wife at a moment of crisis. What was his name? He forced himself to remember. Hugh. Yes, Hugh. It repeated in his mind with the drone of the stadium noise, with Skip Carey and the baseball trivia question. Hugh was the ruptured place in Witt's conscience, one that had, in a self-protective act, gotten walled off. Even now, after two walks and the bases loaded, when he should have been completely immersed in the game, Witt could not stop thinking of the man. He could see how Hugh, the very reality of him, had been inside all along, quietly turning to an abscess. The poisonous mess starting to leak. After the third out, everyone in the stadium stood for the seventh inning stretch, and he stood up and put his journal down on the chair. He thought of the day he'd told Jessie he loved her. They'd been in the rookery, lying on the blanket. "We'll be damned and saved both," he told her. And already it was happening. He closed his eyes and tried to listen to the song the fans on TV were singing. He thought he could blot everything out, calm the anxiety that had begun on the porch with Dominic. But all he wanted now was to bolt and go to her. He felt consumed with the need to pull her into his arms, to claim her again. Jessie, he thought. He could barely stand still. Across the room, Dominic sat in an old lounge chair with his hat in his lap. After Witt had confessed to Dominic all those weeks ago that he'd fallen in love, they hadn't spoken of it again. Of course, the old monk had to know it was Jessie. Why else would he have pulled Witt aside like that and given him this extra bit of information about her husband's being on the island, staying in Nell's house with her? He wanted to concentrate his distress on how upset Jessie must be over her mother, and yet he stood before the television and could not keep himself from imagining her with Hugh. In the kitchen with a glass of wine, the solacing embrace, telling small jokes to break the agony, the myriad ways Hugh might comfort her. He felt frightened by the lifetime of small, secret rituals they must have shared at moments like this, the magnitude of such things. "The man is her husband," he told himself. "For the love of God, he's her husband." Chapter 32. Hugh. His wife stood in her mother's island home in South Carolina and calmly told him the name of her lover. "His name is Brother Thomas," she said. For a moment, Hugh stared at the drops of bathwater sliding along her neck toward the opening of her robe. Her hair was wet and plastered back from her face. He watched how she took a sharp breath with her mouth open and let her gaze drop. They were in the doorway of her brother's old room, and he reached out and placed his hands on the door jamb. He watched her without any pain at all, stood protected and benumbed in the last seconds of a dying illusion, the truth flying toward him with the speed of an arrow, but not yet there. It allowed him to see her one last time before the tip gashed into him and everything changed. What he thought, standing there, was how beautiful she looked, with the bathwater still netted on her skin, running in drops between her breasts. How beautiful. "His name is Brother Thomas." She had said it with complete candor and matter-of-factness, as if she were telling him the name of her dentist. Then it slammed into him, more pain than he'd known in his life. It rocked him backward on his heels, as if there had been a blast of wind.
He went on holding the sides of the door, wondering if he might be having an attack of angina. The power of the feeling was crushing. He stepped back, engulfed suddenly with fury. He wanted to smash his fist into the wall. Instead, he waited for her to raise her eyes to his face again. "Brother Thomas," he'd said with lacerating calm. "Is that what you call him when you're fucking him?"
"Hugh," she said.
It came out broken and splintered. It sounded pleading in a way that enraged him even more. He could tell she had shocked herself with the admission. Her eyes seemed dazed and frantic. Stumbling toward him, reaching out to grab his arm, she looked like a scalded animal trying to understand what had happened to it. When her hand found his arm, he wrenched it out of her grasp.
"Get away," he said through his teeth.
He watched her back out of the room, her lips moving with no words coming out and her eyes wide. He slammed the door and locked it. She stood outside.
"Hugh, open the door, please, Hugh."
There was scarcely any light in the room, and he'd stared at the back of the door, at the shadows running across it like pieces of wire and black vines. He wanted to wound her with his silence. Later, though, it occurred to him that he may have wanted to protect her, too, from the pulverizing things he could have said. She went on calling him for an unbearable amount of time. When she finally left, tears shot up behind his eyes. He sat on one of the twin beds, trying to choke down the urge to cry. He wouldn't have Jesse hearing him cry. He needed to get hold of himself. The force of his anger had started to frighten him. He had an overwhelming need to go to the monastery and find the man. He wanted to take him by the throat and pin him to the wall of the church. He stayed in the dark little room like that for hours. In the beginning, he was gripped by repeated convulsions of anguish, by an actual trembling in his limbs. After that subsided, he was able to think. When he'd asked Jesse the question, "Who is he?" he hadn't really believed there was anyone else. Not really. The possibility that there could be another man had come to him in a flash of intuition as he'd looked at her paintings. He'd been shocked by them, by their highly charged eroticism, by the depth of the plunge the woman in them was taking. It had been like looking at a death, Jessie's death. Her previous life, all the old adaptations and roles, were breaking away and rising to the surface while the woman kept going deeper and deeper. He'd stood there, confused, puzzled by what she might be plunging toward. And then he'd seen the sketch of the two lovers embracing at the bottom of the ocean. The flash had come instantly. It had struck him to the heart. The couple at the bottom of the ocean. That place where you have gone as far as you can go. When he'd first seen the image and the crazy idea had seized him, he'd stood there for several minutes, then thought, no, it was preposterous to think Jesse capable of that. Preposterous! He'd always trusted her, without question. But it explained so much. Her uncommunicative behavior, almost from the moment she'd gotten to Egret Island, the strange abruptness of her wanting time apart from him, her inability to articulate any reason for it. She'd been aloof even before departing Atlanta, depressed about Dee's leaving for college, questioning herself, her life. And so he'd asked the question. It had just come out. Who is he? It occurred to him that Jesse had answered him truthfully, not only because she wanted to end her deceit, but because she wanted to force something to happen. Realizing this, he felt a vibration of panic in his chest. Could it be this was not a casual affair? Did she actually love this man? He spread his hand across his chest and pressed hard against the sick, betrayed feeling. He began to feel emptied out, a deep-boned sadness. On and off during the night, he lay down and tried to sleep, but it was useless to try, and each time he would get up again and pace beside Jesse's paintings,
which sat on the floor leaning against the opposite twin bed. Through the small window he could see the sky lightening slightly, black turning to gray, that smoked look that comes before dawn. And for the 100th time he looked at his watch. There was no way off the island until the first ferry run at 9, but he knew that the moment it was light enough, he would leave the house. When he stepped into the hallway, it was not yet 6. He carried his suitcase to the living room and set it down, then wandered back to Jessie's room. Her door was closed, and he simply opened it and walked in. She was sleeping the way he'd seen her sleep for 20 years, on her right side, with her hair spread behind her on the pillow and her hand tucked under her cheek. The window panes were silver. Daylight had just begun to seep in. He stood there and watched her, studying the gray in her hair, the saliva gathered in the corners of her open mouth, the soft grating breath that was almost, but not quite, a snore. And all these things had made him want to lie down beside her. The wedding ring was gone from her finger. He found it on a velvet pincushion on top of the dresser, circled around a straight pin. He touched it with his finger, thinking of the geese in her painting, how she'd jettisoned them to the surface. He twisted his gold band off his finger and placed it on top of hers. 9 days later, back home in Atlanta, he still felt the same hopelessness that had come over him that night. For the last 20 minutes, the patient seated in his office had been talking about the death of her 18-year-old dachshund, Abercrombie, alternately recounting stories of his life and crying. He'd let her go on and on about the dog because, today, it was just easier. And he suspected she wasn't crying for the dog anyway, but for her brother, who died 3 months earlier after years of estrangement, and for whom she'd cried not a tear. The woman pulled the last tissue from the box beside her and held out the empty carton to him like a child needing her glass refilled. He got up from his leather armchair and pulled more tissues from the louvered cabinet beneath the bookshelf, then sat down again, forcing his mind off Jessie and onto his patient's dissociated feelings. It had been like this since he'd returned, this painful inability to concentrate. One moment he would be listening to his patient, and the next he was back at that moment, Jessie announcing the name Brother Thomas.
"I don't know what else I could have done," his patient said, sitting on the sofa with her legs tucked under her. "Abercrombie's arthritis was getting so bad he couldn't walk, and he was on so many steroids already. I mean, really, what else could I have done?"
"I'm sure you did the right thing by putting him down," Hugh told her, which prompted her to begin crying again. He watched her bent head bobbing up and down in her hands and castigated himself for sitting in the room with her and not being present, for hearing everything she said and not listening to any of it. His mind wandered, and he was standing once more before the picture Jessie had made with colored pencils. The man was a monk. This was not as shocking as the thought of Jessie. His Jessie having an affair, but it was still stunning to him. She had wanted him to know, otherwise she would have simply answered by saying Thomas. He couldn't imagine why she'd added brother, unless there was an unconscious message in it somewhere. What? Did she want him to know how much this man would have to give up to be with her? Since returning, he'd felt his life continually imploding, the emptiness welling up like the immense reaches of space. 2 nights ago, he dreamed he was an astronaut making a spacewalk, tethered to the space shuttle by a cord that had suddenly snapped. He had simply drifted off into an abyss of darkness, watching his craft grow smaller and smaller until it was a speck of white in the silence. His hatred for the man Jessie had been with would come over him with torrential suddenness. He would picture the two of them, how the man would touch her in places that had belonged only to him, breathing into her hair. How many times had they done it? Where? He had wakened once in a drenching sweat, wondering if they were having sex right then, at that very moment.
It had been humbling to discover his capacity for violence and revenge. He'd acknowledged this, like all good analysts, in a theoretical way while studying Jung's concept of the personal and collective shadow. But he knew it now as a living reality. He had stopped envisioning himself going to the monastery and taking the man by the throat, but he did not deny there were moments he wanted the monk to choke and bleed. He would never act on it, of course, but even the wanting to, the needing to, expelled cherished notions he'd held about himself. He was not special. He was not entitled. His goodness, his enlightenment, did not set him apart. He was like all the rest, carrying around the same huge quantities of darkness. The knowledge of this had driven him down into his own humanity. Once in a while, when he was capable of seeing himself as more than the pain he felt, he'd hoped his suffering was not being squandered, that somewhere inside it was making him pliant and tender. The woman across the room from him, he realized, was explaining the details of her dog's death.
"He was in such pain. Just to pick him up made him yelp. So the vet came to the car to give him the shot. Abercrombie was lying on the back seat, and when he saw Dr. Yarbrough, do you know what he did?"
Hugh shook his head.
"He looked up at him and wagged his tail. Can you believe that?"
Yes, Hugh thought. He could believe that. When Jesse had called him that Sunday and asked him to come, he'd gone just like the damn stupid dog, wagging his tail. He'd thought he was going to a reconciliation. He'd thought whatever had come over her had run its course. It had been easy to see how much she'd changed. She looked tired and frazzled from the ordeal with Nell, but underneath, he'd sensed aliveness. There was an unmistakable independence taking hold, a self-containment that hadn't been there before. He'd seen how her paintings had changed, too, exploding out of their little boxes, becoming bold excerpts of the mystifying process she was in. In the past, so much of her had been invisible to him. Looking at her in the hospital waiting room after being apart from her for so long, he'd been able to see her again. How often did we do that, he wondered. Look at someone and fail to see what's really there. Why had it been so hard to look at his wife and understand his need for her? The way his life was held in the accumulation of moments they'd shared. He looked at the woman in front of him and tried for a second to see her. She was telling him now about the pet cemetery. He touched the odd little bracelet on his wrist. The last time Dee had phoned had been his birthday.
"When is Mom coming home?" she'd asked.
He'd paused. Too long.
"Something's wrong, isn't it? She's been there forever."
"I won't lie to you, honey. We're having a few problems," he'd told his daughter. "But nothing that serious, okay? Every marriage has them. We'll work it out."
5 days later, the bracelet had arrived. She'd made it herself. He didn't know what to tell Dee now. He didn't know what to tell himself. He looked at the clock in the office just over the woman's head. He dreaded the end of the day. At night, Jesse's paintings haunted him, waking him up. He would sit on the side of the bed, remembering how the colors had grown fiercer the farther the woman went. Last night, desperate to alleviate his anguish, he tried to look at what Jesse had done not as a husband, but as a psychiatrist. The impulse was ludicrous, but the analytical thinking had given him a hallowed hour or two of distance from his torment. It had aerated his emotions, generated a measure of perspective. He was grateful for every small mercy. What he'd done was go to his study and flip around in various books, reading and jotting notes. Over and over he'd come across the same idea, not the least bit unfamiliar to him, that when a person was in need of cataclysmic change, of a whole new center in the personality, for instance, his or her psyche would induce an infatuation, an erotic attachment, an intense falling in love. He knew this. Every analyst knew it.
Falling in love was the oldest, most ruthless catalyst on Earth. But typically, you fell in love with something missing in yourself that you recognized in the other person. Yet he couldn't grasp what Jesse had seen in this supposedly spiritual man that could capture her so profoundly. After almost an hour of this kind of thing, he'd shoved his notes back in the drawer and returned to bed. It had suddenly felt like a lot of abstract drivel. He didn't want to apply any of it to Jesse. He didn't want to bring the grace of understanding into it. Her reasons were unforgivable, no matter how powerful they were. His wife had been with another man. She had betrayed him. And even if she came to him begging, he didn't know if he could ever take her back.
Dr. Sullivan? His patient said.
He had pivoted away from her toward the window, his elbow on the chair arm, his chin on his fist, and was staring at the outline of the Bradford pear tree flowering profusely against the pane. His eyes were burning with tears. Turning toward the woman, he felt intense embarrassment. She handed him the tissue box she'd been cradling, and he took one and awkwardly dabbed at his eyes. I'm sorry, he said. He shook his head, astonished at himself.
No, please, she said, crossing her hands one on top of the other at her neck. Don't apologize. I'm touched.
She thought his tears were for her, for her dachshund. She was smiling at him, awestruck by his godlike heart. He didn't know how to tell her his emotion had nothing to do with her, that in fact he was being the worst possible psychiatrist at the moment. We all fail one another, he said. The woman's eyes widened as she cast around for his meaning. I have failed my wife, he added. Jesse had failed him, yes, horribly. But he'd failed her, too. He had carelessly glossed over her. He had not given her the small kindness of letting her grow into herself.
I have failed people, the woman said, as if he were trying out an innovative new approach and she was joining in.
You mean your brother? He said gently, and heard the sob break loose in her and fill the room. Chapter 33 I brought Mother home from the hospital on St. Sonara's Day, Saturday, April 30th, a day flooded with brightness. After 13 days in the hospital, Mother had made enough progress to come home, which seemed to mean she was medicated enough not to hurt herself again. According to the nurse, she'd been pleasant without exhibiting aberrant behavior, but had refused to open up. These things take time, the nurse had explained. Then given me a slightly patronizing talk on the importance of Mother's coming back weekly to see her psychiatrist and faithfully swallowing her pills. As I boarded the ferry early that morning, preparations for St. Sonara's Day were already underway. One of the monks was on all fours at the edge of the dock, laying out a rectangle of coral-colored carpet on which the mermaid chair would sit after its winding procession from the abbey. When I was a girl, the carpet had invariably been red, though one year it had turned up pink and fringed, with the suspicious look of a bath mat, which set off a small controversy. A folding table had been set up, and Shem's wife, Mary Eva, was setting out boxes of mermaid tears, which would be thrown into the sea during the ceremony. Crossing the bay, I thought of the mermaid tears I'd kept on top of the crab trap in Witt's Hermitage. I hadn't been out there since Mother had gone to the hospital. Nor had I seen Witt. Not once in 2 weeks. I'd sent him a note, passed along by Cat, explaining I would be spending my days at the hospital with Mother and wouldn't be able to see him for a while. He had not sent a note back. He had not walked to the edge of Mother's backyard and looked over the brick wall and called me out of the house. I was there alone each night, and he didn't come. Maybe he suspected that my note didn't tell the whole story. Perhaps he detected the sadness beneath my words. The morning after I'd confessed my affair to Hugh, I'd found his wedding ring on the pincushion along with mine, and no trace of him in the house.
I'd rushed out, wanting to catch him at the ferry dock before he left the island. But by the time I reached the slave cemetery, I thought better of it. I remembered the way he'd recoiled, almost violently, when I'd reached for him. The rage in his voice when he'd told me to get away. He had said it with his teeth clenched. His eyes had looked so pained, so shocked. I did not recognize him. It seemed now I could at least spare him the fresh sight of me. I could do that much for him. Depression had descended then like a great fatigue, and I'd sat down beside the graves and watched a dove scratch the dirt, making small, neglected sounds that were heartbreaking to me. It was as if someone had suddenly handed me a huge stone, the weight of all the suffering I'd caused, and said, "Here, you must carry this now." So I had, these 13 days. It is still hard for me to understand, much less explain, the descent that comes with necessary loss, how requisite it is. It came to me like the darkening of the day. It wasn't that I rued what I'd done, that I wanted a reversal of some kind. I would not have taken back the way my loving wit had impregnated me with life, with myself, the 100 ways I'd been broken and made larger. It's that I saw the effect of it. I saw it in the immortal hurt in Hugh's eyes, in the bracelet Dee had woven for him, in the unbearable ceremony our rings were performing on the pincushion. Each morning I'd left the island and returned in the late afternoon. I'd sat with Mother in what they called the day room, with its television and sofas and strange shuffling people. It had reminded me of Dante's Purgatorio, which I'd read in school. The only part of the story I remembered was the inhabitants lugging huge stones around a mountain. I'd watched the medicines make Mother docile, watched everything from a place of fallowness and grief, always going back to the moment when Hugh saw through it all and posed his question. It stupefied me daily that I'd answered him without hesitation, using Witt's monk name, as if underscoring his spiritual credentials, as if that somehow made what we were doing loftier. Mother had sat each day with her body slackened on the chair, moving her fingers around the Rubik's Cube that I'd brought her from home. She'd asked me so many times about her finger, I'd finally brought that, too. I'd washed it under the faucet one night, forcing myself to hold the lost piece of her in my palm and scrub the bloodstains. I'd brought it to her in a mason jar, submerged in rubbing alcohol so it wouldn't putrefy. I'd gotten permission for her to keep it in her room, but just in case, I'd written, "Do not throw away," on the side of the jar. In the evenings, I'd given progress reports to Cat and Hepzibah on the phone, warm soup from the cans in the pantry, and listened to the endless soliloquy of sadness and blame that went on and on inside me. Whenever I thought of Wit, I'd long to be with him. But I didn't know any more whether my wanting came from love or the simple need to be comforted. Despite that, I couldn't let myself be with him yet. It seemed perverse to make love with him, given the freshness of the pain Hugh was in, that we were both in. No doubt it was illogical, but I felt I was abstaining out of respect for the death of my marriage. Mother seemed excited as we left the hospital that afternoon. Inside the rental car, she pulled down the sun visor and dragged a comb through her white hair, then astonished me by dabbing on her old fire engine red lipstick. She blotted her lips on a gas receipt she found on the seat. It was a gesture of such normalcy that I smiled at her. "You look nice," I said, worried for a moment that she might respond by wiping the color off her lips, but she'd smiled back. The ferry was crammed with tourists. Not even standing room was left. Mother clutched the jar that held her finger like a child bringing a goldfish home from the store. I had wrapped it in a paper towel fastened with a rubber band, but she still got a few curious looks from the passengers. As we got closer, I could see the line of shrimp trawlers already forming on the southeast side of the island, out on the Atlantic. "It's St. Sanara's Day," I said to Mother.
"You think I don't know that?" she snapped.
She had not gone to the festivities since Dad died. As she had with the all-girls picnics, she'd simply eradicated them from her life. Her abolishing this one, however, had genuinely puzzled me. Sanara was, after all, her saint. Cat met us at the dock, smelling like the lavender lotion she used. Not Benny, just Cat. She kissed Mother on the cheek. I hadn't expected her. Mother inspected the dock, the boxes of mermaid tears, as well as a small table from the monastery with a silver cruet on top. The one used year after year to splash seawater across the mermaid chair. I watched her eyes search for the coral carpet at the dock's edge. Max was stretched out on it, as if the rug had been put there specifically for him. She stared at the wedge of carpet with something like revulsion in her face. And I imagined she was picturing the mermaid chair sitting on top of it.
"Let's take a walk," Cat said, grasping Mother by the arm. "You too, Jessie."
She whisked Mother across the dock, down to the sidewalk where I'd left the golf cart. I was about to slide behind the wheel, but Cat guided Mother on past it. I set her suitcase down on the seat and followed. I remember being aware of a small passing dread and pushing it aside. I didn't ask where we were going. I think I was under the impression Cat wanted to distract Mother from the moment on the dock when she'd seen the rug. I trailed behind them, along the row of shops, past Caw Caw General and the island dog B&B, listening to Cat ply Mother with harmless questions. The smell of fried shrimp coming from Max's cafe was so thick the air felt oily. I checked my watch. It was 5 in the afternoon, the light slumping, the clouds veined with red. The day was taking on the first bloodshot look of sunset. The festivities would begin at 6, when every monk and islander who could walk would come pouring onto the dock behind the mermaid chair. Leading the parade, the abbot would be decked out in chasuble and stole and carrying his crozier. And somewhere in all that hoopla would be Wit. Beneath the striped awning of the mermaid's tail, Cat paused and, using her key, opened the door. The sign in the window said closed. Absurd as this sounds, not even then did it cross my mind that our stroll might have some purpose other than diverting Mother from whatever horrible old memory had settled over her back on the dock. Stepping inside the shop behind them, listening to the sounds on the street seep away, I noticed Hepzibah, Shem, and Father Dominic standing at the rear of the store near the cash register. Back there, with the boat wreck picture I'd painted when I was 11, the flames beneath the water, all the happy sea creatures. Dominic was not wearing his robe or his hat, but instead a suit with his priest's collar. Shem, flushed and constrained-looking, had his arms folded across his barrel of a chest and his hands stuck under his armpits as if someone had forced him there at gunpoint. Apparently, catching sight of them at the same moment as I, Mother stopped in the middle of the store. She stood paralyzed, surrounded by Cat's great convocation of mermaids. They hung over her from the ceiling in the form of aluminum wind chimes and flanked her on all sides in an array of ceramic sculptures, necklaces, soap carvings, candles, and beach towels. I watched her begin to take small steps backward across the floor. Hepzibah hurried toward her with a funny mixture of determination and reluctance in her face, that look of moving toward what must be done. She lassoed Mother with both her arms, stopping her in her tracks.
"It's gonna be all right, Nell. I promise you. We're just gonna have a talk, okay?"
Even now, that image never leaves me. Mother, standing in the dark circle of Hepzibah's arms, not moving a muscle, clasping her jaw with excruciating stillness. There were 2 sharp clicks, and I realized Cat had locked the door behind us. I swung around to her then. For heaven's sake, what's all this about? Groping for my hands, Cat held them tightly in front of her. I'm sorry, Jessie, she said. I haven't been honest with you. I'm an obstinate, know-it-all damn idiot of a woman who thought I was doing the right thing. And I guess what I've done is to make it worse. I drew my head back slightly, taking in her face. It had the look of ice about to break. Her eyes were tightened, her mouth hitched to the side to keep from crying, and I knew what it must have taken for her to say these words. I felt myself bracing for what lay behind them.
It's just, I swear to you, I didn't think Nell was as bad off as she was.
But why are we here? The day we were up there in the hospital waiting room, I realized if I didn't at least try to get everything out in the open, Nell was going to end up bleeding to death one night. If remembering is what she needs, like you and Hugh said, then okay. By God, we are going to sit here and remember.
My mind spun. It was slowly dawning on me. Cat, Hepzibah, Dominic, Shem, all of them knew. They knew the reason Mother had mutilated herself, why my father's death had more or less ended my mother's life, too. Even why his pipe was buried in her drawer and not in the ocean. These things had been like hibernating cicadas that live in the ground for 17 years, and then one day, when the circadian wheel turns, all come crawling up into the light of day. I glanced back at Dominic, who met my gaze, lifting the sides of his mouth in a tempered smile, trying to reassure me. They'd known for 33 years. When I was a little girl and had painted the boat wreck, when I'd gathered roses in the monastery garden and scattered them like my father's ashes across the island, every time I'd come back to visit, they had known. Hepzibah had settled Mother into one of the folding chairs near the counter. The jar, I noticed, had been tugged away from her and stood between the cash register and a display of sugarless gum. Mother sat with what struck me as remarkable resignation. Hepzibah had not worn any kind of headdress today, but had done her hair in cornrows. I stared at her a moment as she worked a finger along the little hedges, her other hand patting Mother's arm. The last time I'd sat over there, Cat, Hepzibah, and Benny had been eating butter pecan ice cream. Standing at the door next to Cat, I considered for the first time that what they were doing, this so-called remembering, as Cat had put it, might not be good for Mother. I couldn't believe that I, of all people, was thinking this after everything I'd had to say. But what if the truth overwhelmed her, caused her to break down again, to curl up in a ball on the floor? I leaned over to Cat, keeping my voice low. I want Mother to confront things as much as anyone does, but is this the right way to go about it? I mean, she just got out of the hospital.
I called Hugh this morning, Cat said.
Hugh? I said his name and felt it magnify in the room, the way it sucked up the air.
I wouldn't be doing this if he hadn't said it was okay, she assured me. Actually, he seemed to think it was a fairly brilliant idea.
Really? I acted surprised, but I could easily see how he would rally behind this, loving friends gathering around Mother, helping her confront the thing that was slowly destroying her. Cat said,
Hugh suggested we just talk with her like friends, not push her too much. She has to be the one to say it.
It. And did you explain to him what it was? I asked. She looked away from me.
I told him everything.
Oh, but you couldn't tell me?
My voice was filled with exasperation and anger.
You have to ambush me along with Mother?
She shook her head, making the wisps of her hair float around her face. I could hear the others across the room murmuring in the quiet.
I don't blame you for being angry, Kat said, her testiness back.
Okay, I deserve it. I do believe we've settled that. But do me a favor and do not call this an ambush, whether you want to believe it or not. It comes out of love for Nell and nothing else.
She stood there, gesticulating, small and tough. And I did not doubt she loved my mother. That she had carried around my mother's misery these last 33 years as if it somehow belonged to her, too.
It was you who convinced me we all needed to talk about this, she railed.
Plus Nell up there in a hospital bed with one more finger chopped off.
I would have told you about it sooner, but it took me until last night to work it all out in my head. I didn't know if I could go through with it till this morning.
I took a breath, feeling myself give way, annoyed she had turned to Hugh, but relieved at the same time. Kat began to unruffle herself.
Hugh said Nell was stabilized on medicine now, and that even her doctor thinks she's ready to go back and look at what started everything.
So, I thought, Hugh had stayed in touch with Nell's doctor. Kat and I went over and sat down, me next to Mother, while Shem and Dominic took the last two chairs.
I didn't know anything about this, I told Mother.
If you don't hate me already, you will, she responded.
Nobody is going to hate anybody, Kat said. I realize getting you here wasn't the most straightforward thing in the world, but the fact is, we need to do this.
Mother stared into her palms, cupped like small basins on each of her knees.
Look, I stopped at your house and got your rosary, Kat said.
She reached in her pocket, drew out the red beads and coiled them into Mother's good hand. She closed her fingers around them.
What do you want me to do? Just try to put what happened with Joe into words, Dominic told her.
We waited. My heart began to beat convulsively. I didn't want to know. I'd more or less pushed everyone into this, and now I felt undone at the thought of what it might be.
If you don't hate me already, you will.
Mother turned her head and looked at me, and it was like staring into a dark hatchway, so much black sorrow below.
I'm not going to hate you, I said. You need to talk about it, whatever it is.
I could see the chinks in her resistance. We all could. We sat there avoiding one another's eyes. The silence turned oceanic. Outside, the St. Sonora crowd that had come over on the ferry was beginning to line the sidewalk to wait for the mermaid chair. I could see a cluster of them through the plate glass window at the front, imagining them out there doing the ordinary things people did, window shopping, licking snow cones, lifting their children onto their shoulders. These acts of daily grace filled me with the ache one has for such seeming insignificance only when it goes missing. I wanted everything to be ordinary again. To walk around with a glorious nonchalance reserved for oblivious people.
Your father. He was ill.
Mother said. The words spit into the middle of us like the hard, bitter pit of some fruit she'd been eating. She paused and looked toward the door.
Nell, Dominic said, go ahead and say it. We'll all be the better for it. Do it for yourself and for Jesse. Do it for our blessed Saint Sonara.
Immediately, the room filled with brilliance. It was only the sun dropping through fathoms of sky, hitting the window and bombarding us with light beams, but in that way of magical thinking, it seemed as if Sonara had lifted her hand to bless Dominic's words, causing light to rise and scatter. Mother crossed herself.
It was the same disease his father had, she said. She was resolved now. It was hardened in her eyes. It's called Pick's disease.
She stared at the hardwood planks on the floor as if directing her story to them, but clearly she was talking to me.
When he was a little boy, Joe watched his own father, your grandfather, grow senile and die with it. Back then, though, they just called it dementia. It wasn't till Joe got diagnosed with it that they realized what kind of dementia his father probably had.
I shut my eyes. Pick's disease. I'd never even heard of it. I could feel the ground swell, the whirling up of grief. In my mind, I saw Boneyard Beach, with gale winds surging off the water and ripping into the dunes, knowing that it would rearrange the island into new contours.
When we first met, Joe told me about his father, how the disease destroyed his brain.
She spoke in a halting, heavy way, each word laid down like a brick she was trying to lift and place just right.
But I don't think it ever entered his mind that he could get it. There's just the smallest tendency for it to run in families. He just talked about how there wasn't a cure, that kind of thing.
She crossed herself again. Tears were beading up in the gray floss of her lashes, she said.
One time, his father got him mixed up with a boy he'd known growing up. It nearly killed Joe. Later, his father couldn't place him at all. The disease completely ate his memory.
That's how Joe always put it.
Like it was devouring his father from the inside out. It got where he couldn't talk right, and the spit would run out of his mouth. At the end, Joe's mother was always mopping his chin, and finally she put a bib on him.
She was leaning forward in her chair, her words suddenly pouring out in a turbulent stream. It seemed that finding a crack, the force of the story had thrown the door wide open. In the beginning, he said it was mostly his father's personality that started changing. He did things, real odd things. He'd shout at people on the street for no good reason, or blurt out something crazy.
A lot of times, it would be something lewd, like he'd lost all his inhibitions.
But the part that got stuck the worst in Joe's head was the day his father knocked him onto the floor. When he saw what he'd done, he started crying. "I'm sorry, little boy. I'm sorry." Like he didn't know who he was. Joe broke down every time he remembered it. I think it was a relief when his father finally died. He was 10 years old, and his father just 48. Her eyes looked shrunken, tiny almonds in her face. The big crucifix on the end of the rosary hung off the edge of her lap, swaying slightly as she worked the beads with her fingers in the accomplished way of old nuns. Hepzibah reached over and patted her arm, her hands, the lumps and dough of her skin, wanting, it seemed, to mold her back together.
"Go on. Tell the rest now."
Mother wiped at her eyes.
"Joe came to me one day and said he was sure he had his father's disease. He'd been out in the boat, and when he tried to throw out the anchor line, he couldn't remember where he kept it, or even how to say the words anchor line in his head. He was so confused he came straight back to the dock, afraid he'd forget where that was." I can still see his face when he walked through the kitchen door. How pale and scared it was. He said, "God help me, Nell. I have the disease." He knew it, and I think I did too. There'd been other signs, little things slipping his mind.
Plus, he'd been losing his temper over nothing and just not thinking straight.
A few months later, the doctors in Charleston told us what we already knew.
She did not look at us.
She made a little altar of the floor, of the light shafts, of the granules of dust illuminated inside them, and concentrated her eyes upon it.
"Your father did not want to forget your name," she said.
And I could hear the desperation in her voice, the ragged way it sounded in her throat.
"He did not want to forget Mike's name either.
But it was your name, Jesse, that he would wake up shouting. Sometimes he would bolt out of his sleep crying, 'I'm sorry, little girl. I'm sorry.'"
She rocked her body back and forth, and I knew in my bones that's what she must have done when he woke like that, taken him in her arms and rocked back and forth with him. I couldn't bear watching her. My mind went to the time I found my mother and father in the kitchen, dancing without music. They had poured so much love on each other.
I told him 1,000 times, "You won't forget your children's names. I won't let you. God will cure you."
She had begun twisting the rosary in her hands. I slid forward and reached out to touch her. I wanted my mother. I wanted to bend over and kiss her the way a mother kisses her injured child. My love for her was such a rubble. The rosary fell onto the floor. She began talking to my father as if he were sitting in the room with us.
"Don't ask me to do this, Joe. Please, don't ask me. I'll walk on my knees across the island if I have to. I won't eat. I'll sleep on the floor on the dirty ground. I'll make God hear me. Jesus and Mary, don't ask me to do this. It would be damnation for us."
Her face was blazing. The light on the floor had disappeared as if it had boiled away. Mother stared at the darkness rising around our feet, the quiet way the shadows pooled out from under the chairs. Cat reached down and picked up the rosary. None of us said a word. I had the blurred, disoriented feeling of floating, waving like an eel in the ocean. I could grasp nothing. What was she trying to say? I believe, though, part of me knew. I began pulling air down the chute of my throat, into my lungs, like stuffing cotton batting into a pillow that would soon absorb an unthinkable blow. Mother turned slowly to face me.
"He wouldn't listen to me. Every time I refused to do it, he smiled and said, 'Nell, it'll be okay. God won't blame you. Why, it's God's tender mercy you'll be dispensing. Let me have my dignity. Let me go the way I need to.'"
I understood then. I think I must have made a sound, a moan. It caused them all to turn and stare at me. Even Mother. I felt awe at the sight of her.
"I shouldn't have listened to him," Mother said. "Why did I listen to him?"
Dominic's eyelids were opening and closing repeatedly, and all I could think of was how thin they seemed, two bluish white films. I sat in amazement, the translucence that comes when life hardens into a bead of such cruel perfection you see it with the purest clarity. Everything suddenly there. Life, as it truly is, enormous, appalling, devastating. You see the great sinkholes it makes in people and the harrowing lengths to which love will go to fill them. Mother had started to sob. Her head drooped toward her chest, heaving up and down with her shoulders. I reached for her hand because it was there and it had to be taken. Because I both loved and hated her for what she'd done. But mostly, I pitied her.
Her hand was leaden and damp. I touched the veins twisting toward her knuckles.
You did the only thing you could, I said.
It was all I could manage, this concession, this forbearance. I wasn't sure if she would tell me how she did it, whether I wanted to know. I began to feel the first traces of relief. I looked at Dominic, silently moving his lips, and thought it was a prayer of thanksgiving that Mother's surrender to the past was finally over. I believe that as ghastly as the truth was, it was at least out. I believed it could not get worse. These were my mistakes. Hepzibah brought Mother a glass of water. We watched solemnly as she found her composure and drank it. The sound of her swallowing exaggerated in the silence. A picture came into my mind, rummaging through her dresser drawer, finding the pipe. It wasn't the pipe that caused it, I said to her. It was never the pipe.
No, she said.
The skin on her face was rubbery and pouched, like small deflated balloons beneath her eyes. There was an expression in her eyes, though, the empty calm that follows catharsis.
Do you know what dead finger is, Jessie? Said Cat.
I turned to her, startled.
What?
I sat there stupidly thinking she must be referring to Mother's finger in the jar on the counter. The room was utterly still.
Dead finger, she repeated.
She said it with softness, with kindness.
It's a plant. It's from the nightshade family.
She looked at me quizzically to see if I grasped her meaning. It's very poisonous, she added. I understood instantly. My father had died from ingesting some kind of toxic plant. I stood up, shaking my head. How do you suddenly revise images and understandings you've carried in the cells of your body for 33 years? I walked to the counter and leaned on the worn wood, lowering my head into my hands. Dead finger, I said, realizing the name had started all Mother's warped reasons for mutilating herself. Hepzibah came and stood beside me. She touched my shoulder.
It used to grow around the slave cemetery. It still crops up sometimes if I'm not careful. It's a shrub with fuzzy leaves and grayish-white blossoms shaped like fingers, and it has a terrible rotting odor. You've probably seen it on the island.
No, I said, still cradling my head, not wanting to picture it.
It's more merciful than other nightshades. Back in the 40s and 50s, people here used to put their pets out of their misery. Your father died peacefully, Jessie. He fell asleep, and he didn't wake up.
I turned around to Mother, who appeared tranquil, but spent.
How did you know what to do? I didn't think you knew anything about plants.
She didn't answer. What she did was to look at Cat and then at Hepzibah.
They had been part of it, too.
You helped her? I said, looking from one to the other. Cat glanced at the floor, then back at me.
We did it because your father asked us. He came to each one of us. To Shem and Dominic, too, begging our help the same way he did your mother's. We love Joe. We would have done anything for him, but none of us arrived at this easily.
I looked at Dominic, confused. Why would my father make him part of this? Cat and Hepzibah, I understood. They were devoted to Mother, and Dad would have known how much she would need them afterward. Shem had been his best friend. But Dominic? He read my expression.
Come sit down, Dominic told me, and waited while I went and lowered myself into the chair. Joe came to me one day and said he was going to die, that it would be a long, horrible death, and he couldn't put himself through it, much less his family. He said he would like to leave his life sitting in the mermaid chair. He wanted to sit in the holiest spot on the island, surrounded by his wife and his friends.
Dominic couldn't have said anything in the world that would have surprised me more, or at the same time seemed more natural, truer to my father.
"Your father was a charming man," he said. "He had what I would call an imaginative sense of humor, and he used it even then. He told me with a grin that God once sent real live mermaids to his boat, which he pointed out was surely a sign that when he died, he should be sitting in the chair holding on to them. But mostly, what he wanted was..."
Dominic looked at Mother.
"He wanted to sit in the chair because it needed to be a holy place for Nell's sake. I was supposed to be the officiant, you know, preside over his dying, give him last rites, then absolve Nell and the rest of us. I told him no at first. I was the last holdout."
I was still trying to reconfigure my father's dying, change the pictures, the accompanying feelings. I tried to imagine him sitting in the mermaid chair, staring into Mother's face, slowly slipping into a coma. Had I been asleep in my bed while all of this happened? Had he come to my room to say goodbye? A fragment of memory hung in my head like a little green fruit that had never ripened. Opening my eyes, seeing him standing by my bed. The whirligirl he'd peeled for me earlier that evening sat browning on my bedside table, and I watched him reach out and touch it with his fingers. "Daddy?" My voice was woozy with sleep.
"Shh," he said. "It's okay."
He knelt on the floor and, sliding his arm under my shoulder, held me against his chest, my cheek crushed against the rough nap of his corduroy shirt. He smelled of pipe tobacco and apples. "Jesse," he said, "my little whirligirl." I was sure I heard the soft sound of his crying. He sang my name over and over, soft against my ear, before lowering me back to my pillow, back into the fuzzy world of my dreams. I'd always known these things had taken place. As a child, every time I'd sung my name across the empty marsh, I'd known. I just never understood until now that they'd happened on the night he died. I was holding the sides of my chair. I was trying to keep myself there. "Why did you change your mind?" I asked Dominic.
"Joe was determined," he said, "and not just charming, but shrewd. He let me know he was going to take his life whether I helped him or not, but that it would be so much better for Nell if I did. I realized I could either stand on dogma and turn my back, or I could take something terrible and inevitable and bestow a little mercy on it. I decided to try to help the situation."
I started to say the obvious, that gathering around a holy relic and Dominic's absolution of Mother hadn't helped her much in the end. But how did I know? Maybe it had kept her saner than she would have been otherwise. "The boat," I said. "Was he even on it?" Shem, who'd not said a word since we'd sat down, looked up at me with red-rimmed eyes.
"He was on it. I took him to his boat myself, that old Chris Craft of his, and laid him inside it. It was tied up at my dock."
The Jess Sea. It occurred to me suddenly that Shem had been involved not because he was a close friend, but because he knew how to make the boat explode, to make it seem like an accident. Shem looked at Mother as if asking whether he should go on. The last few minutes she'd been quiet and drawn into herself, sagged down into the chair.
"Nell," Shem said,
and she nodded at him. I watched him take a breath. As he exhaled, his chin quivered.
"Joe had already filled the bilge with gasoline and tied the steering wheel, so it would take him straight out into the bay. That night, after I laid him down inside it, I cranked the boat and left it in neutral while I disconnected the battery cable. Then I throttled it up to 10 miles an hour and untied the boat cleat. When it hit choppy water, the loose cable began to bounce around and threw a spark. The boat exploded before it got 200 yards.
But why go to all those lengths just to make it look like an accident? That's crazy.
Mother glared at me like her old combative self. That was the most important thing to your father. He wanted it that way for you. So don't you dare say it was crazy.
I walked over and squatted beside her chair. It was a relief to me that she could be angry, that there was something left inside her.
What do you mean he wanted it that way for me?
She tilted her face down to mine, and I saw her eyes filling up again.
He said his dying would be hard on you, but living with his suicide would be 1,000 times worse. He couldn't bear your thinking he'd abandoned you.
The room grew quiet. Somewhere in the mangled remnants of childhood that were left inside me, I knew that what my father had done had been for me, for his Whirligirl, and I didn't know how to bear the weight of that, the merciless blame of his sacrifice. I closed my eyes and heard my father singing my name soft against my ear, singing his goodbye. Jesse, Jesse, Jesse. As long as he lived, he did not forget my name. I dropped my head straight down onto my mother's lap and sobbed my grief into her thin cotton skirt. I could feel the hard, lacy border of her slip press against my forehead. This was supposed to be about Mother, emptying out all the dark pockets inside and sorting the contents. It was supposed to be about her remembering things and maybe somehow putting her broken self back together. And it had come to this, to me, bent over her lap, her maimed hands coming up to rest on my head. When we stepped outside onto the sidewalk, the dark blue haze of dusk was everywhere. The mermaid chair's procession had already coursed along the street onto the dock. Climbing into the golf cart, I could see the crowd massed along the rails. I imagined the shrimp boats passing by out on the water, with colored lights wound along the raised nets. I pictured the mermaid chair perched on its scrap of coral rug in all that soft, glittering light, freshly splashed and blessed. Mother sat beside me in the golf cart as we drove through the falling darkness, and did not remember she had left her finger on the counter in the store. Chapter 34. In May, the tides went to work hauling away the dead marsh grass. It drifted along the salt creeks like a constant flotilla of rotting, hay-brown rafts. Early in the mornings, when I knew I would be alone, I stole out to the dock in the rookery. I would stand there with the light soaring across the marsh, filling my nostrils with the egg and sperm smell, and watch the great floating exodus, the immaculate, scouring way nature renews herself. After I'd learned how my father had died, there was a lifting away of sorrow. I can't explain that, except to say there's release in knowing the truth, no matter how anguishing it is. You come finally to the irreducible thing, and there's nothing left to do but pick it up and hold it. Then at least you can enter the severe mercy of acceptance. Mother seemed relieved to have the truth come out of its long hibernation. She went on confessing pieces of it to me, usually in the evenings when the day turned dark and grainy and sifted past the windows. She told me that Cat and Hepzibah had boiled batches of the plant leaves and chunks of the root, cooking them down to the consistency of pea soup. My father had insisted on drinking the brew from one of the chalices used during Mass. I'm sure he was trying to help my mother understand that dying is a sacrament, too, that there was holiness in the sacrifice he was making, though I'm sure she never understood it. I'm not at all sure I understood it completely. I didn't know if my father had horned in on God's territory and cut the thread that belonged to the fates. If he'd usurped what wasn't rightly his, the terrifying power to say when. Or did he only usurp God's deep heart, laying his life down as a sacrifice, wanting only to take away our suffering? I didn't know if it was hubris, or fear, or courage, or love, or all of them. In the night, I dreamed of whales thrusting their sickly bodies onto the shore to die willful deaths. At first, I stood there bewildered, screaming for them to go back to the ocean. But in the end, I simply walked among them, running my hands along their mountainous backs, easing them toward the mystery they'd chosen. Mother said my father had held the chalice with both hands and gulped quickly. Later, Dominic had sent the cup with Shem to be placed on the boat, fearing that the poison might never be washed out of it. She told me that as he drank, she started to sob, but he'd gone on swallowing until there was no more, and then, looking at her, said, "I didn't just drink my death, Nell. Try to remember that for me. I drank my life." What I most wished was that my mother could somehow have remembered that, as he'd wanted her to. Hepzibah showed up at the door one day with a jar containing Mother's finger. Mother placed it on a lace handkerchief atop her dresser, between the Mary statue and the photograph of Dad on his boat. Gradually, other objects appeared around it: 3 scallop shells, an old starfish, a sand dollar. It began to look like a small shrine. I didn't ask her what it meant. It seemed wrong, somehow, to intrude. But I felt she was, in some obscure way, offering her finger to the ocean, hoping it might be transformed into something else, the way Sedna's fingers were. One night, as the breezes off Boneyard pulled the scent of the sea through the open windows, I went to Mother's room to say goodnight. She sat at the dresser, gazing at the finger jar. I let my hand brush across her thumb, touching the scar on her index finger. "I wish you'd tell me why you felt you had to do this to yourself," I said. When she looked at me, her eyes were as clear as I'd ever seen them. She said, "Last February, right before Ash Wednesday, I found dead finger growing on the side of the house by the water spigot. I smelled it from the porch. 2 little plants. The next day, there were 3 of them. I'd never had it grow in my yard once since Joe died. And then there it was. I couldn't stop thinking about it, Jesse. I dreamed the leaves were growing through the windows into the house. I had to do something to make it stop. To make everything stop." She lifted her hand to Dad's face in the photograph, and her eyes welled up. "I wanted to make up for what I did, to undo it. I just wanted him back again." That was all she said about it, all she would ever say. She wanted to undo it. She wanted him back. I don't know if I'll ever understand it. Whatever it was she was trying to do by planting her finger in the rose garden and adorning the jar with sea trinkets, it was more than a sad gesture of atonement. It was a last desperate reach for him. I believe that what she wanted was to regrow him from all the cleaved, tortured places inside, to remember him the way he'd been, the way they'd been, before everything happened. She wanted to make the guilt and longing stop. During those days, I compulsively painted my father as I imagined he looked that night, sitting in the mermaid chair, having just drunk his death and his life. Using the photograph on Mother's dresser as a model for his face, I painted him with squinting eyes, his face engraved with weather lines, browned and tough as boot leather, that old salt look visible on so many island faces. He sat very tall and regal, as if on a throne, holding the winged mermaids on the chair arms and gazing out at me. Directly beneath the chair, at the bottom of the canvas, as if down in a subterranean realm under the floor, I painted a rectangular chamber, a secret magical room. Inside it, I painted a little girl. I worked in the living room and occasionally on the porch, unwilling to hide what I was doing from Mother, who would sit for hours and watch with squeamish wonder as his image came forth, as if observing the birth of a baby. I felt that way too, but for different reasons. What I realized was the amazing degree to which my life had been shaped around my father, around his living and dying, the apple peels and the pipe. I saw it clearly as he streamed out from my brushes, Joe Dubois, the hidden, pulsing nucleus around which my life had taken form.
"Who's that in the box under the chair?" Mother asked, peering over my shoulder at the painting. "I suppose it's me," I told her, slightly irritated at her use of the word box. I hadn't thought of it quite like that, but I saw how true it was. The little girl was not in a magic room, a lovely room. She was in a box. The same girl who would grow up to express herself through diminutive art boxes. When I was finished with the portrait, I hung it in my bedroom, where it became almost iconic in its presence, in its ability to speak to me of invisible things. It had never been a secret that I'd idealized my father, that I would have done anything to please him, to be the apple of his eye. To use the worst and most obvious cliché, but what I didn't quite get until the painting was the sadness of all that trying. I hadn't understood the small, powerless places it had taken me. But even more than this, I had never completely realized how this same thing had gone on with Hugh. I'd accommodated myself to him for 20 years without any real idea of what it was to have possession of my own self. To own myself, so to speak. I felt as if I'd found the fairy tale pea hidden under the mattress. The thing that had kept the princess tossing all those nights, that had quietly made her black and blue. I would sit cross-legged on the bed staring at the painting and listening to my tapes on the Walkman, thinking what an ideal father Hugh had been. Not just to Dee, but to me. God, to me too. I couldn't imagine what it would be like if I took that away. If I tried to relate to more than his fatherly side, let him be Hugh. Just Hugh. On Mother's Day, Dee called. I stood in the kitchen holding the wall phone, leaning against the refrigerator. At first, the conversation was all about Happy Mother's Day and summer plans. She told me she would not be taking classes but going home to be with her father. At the mention of Hugh, there was a pause. And then her voice rushed at me, full of anger and incomprehension.
Why are you doing this?
Doing what? It was such a stupid thing to say.
You know what I mean, she shouted. You left him, and you didn't even tell me.
I could hear her crying, these horrible muffled sounds far away. Oh, Dee, I'm sorry. It became one of those songs you sing in rounds. I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry.
Why? She pleaded. Why?
I don't know how to explain any of this to you. In my head, I could hear Wit in the boat that day, the precise words he'd used. I never could make them understand that what I needed was somehow to be alone with myself. In a spiritual way, I mean. He'd called that aloneness a solitude of being.
Try,
she said. There was only so much I could say to her. I drew a breath. This will sound ridiculous, I guess, but my life had started to feel so stagnant, like it was atrophied. Everything shrunk down to the roles I played. I had loved doing them, Dee, I really had, but they were drying up. And they weren't really me. Do you understand? I felt there had to be some other life beneath the one I had, like an underground river or something, and that I would die if I didn't dig down to it. Her silence after I'd spoken was a relief to me. I let myself slide down the refrigerator until I was sitting on the floor. Back there, somewhere, I'd lost the solitude of being that told me who I was, the whole mystery of myself. I'd been incapable of wearing the earth on my arms and legs, of diving and surfacing in my own erotic depths.
"Don't you love Dad anymore?"
Dee asked.
"Of course I do. Of course. How could I not love him?"
I didn't know why I was saying this to her. How much of it was placation, how much true. Hugh and I had gone through our days with such good intentions, but with the imagination leaking out of our togetherness. We'd become exceptionally functional partners in the business of making a life. Even in the hidden business of being what the other one needed, good father, good daughter, little girl in a box. All those ghosts that hide in the cracks of a relationship. It seemed right to have destroyed all that. Not to have hurt Hugh. I would always be sorry for that.
"Are you staying there all summer?" Dee asked.
"I don't know," I told her. "I just know that I didn't know whether to say it, whether she wanted to hear it.
"That you love me," she said.
Which was exactly the thing I was going to say. I showed up at the monastery in the middle of May. The heat had descended in typical fashion, all at once, an oppressive woolen canopy pitched across the island overnight. It would not be lifted until October. Approaching the reception center, I saw a dozen monks sitting on the wide lawn in the abbey quadrangle, hand-tying cast nets. They were spread out in orderly exactitude like chess pieces on a great green board, each with a heap of cotton twine in his lap. I paused, taken back momentarily to my childhood, those days when the monks fled the scourging heat of the net house for the breezes coming off the marsh.
"The air conditioner quit on them," a voice said.
And I turned to find the bald monk I'd met that day in the gift shop when I'd bought Dominic's book. He frowned at me from his huge Jack Benny glasses. It took me a moment to remember his name. Father Sebastian, the humorless one, the one who kept the monastery on the straight and narrow. "I don't know how you get through the summer in these robes," I replied.
"It's a small sacrifice we make," he said. "People don't want to make sacrifices anymore."
The steady way he gazed at me, emphasizing the word sacrifices, gave me an odd feeling, and I thought suddenly of my father. I turned to stare again at the monks on the grass.
"Are you looking for Brother Thomas?" he asked.
I whirled around.
"No! Why would I?"
I was stunned by his question, and I'm sure it showed on my face.
"You don't really want me to answer that, do you?" he said.
How could he possibly know about Wit and me? I couldn't believe Wit would have confided in him. In Dominic, maybe, but not Sebastian. "No," I said, and it was barely a whisper. "I don't." I drew back my shoulders and walked away, out into the cloister square toward the abbey church. The wind had blown snipped off bits of twine all over the place. It looked as if the fates had come through on a binge of cutting. One of the monks was chasing a strand, repeatedly reaching for it just as the wind snatched it away. Something about this filled me with sorrow and longing. I began picking up pieces of thread as I walked, whatever little scraps were in my path, tucking them into my pocket. I could feel Sebastian still there, watching me. I hadn't lied to him. I had not come to see Wit. I was here because no matter how hard I tried, I couldn't resist the morbid fascination of seeing the mermaid chair again, in light of what I now knew about my father's dying. But it was also true that I'd come in the morning when I knew that Wit would be on the abbey grounds and not in the rookery. I had washed my hair. I had worn the aqua shirt. I hadn't seen him in almost a month, not since Mother's hospitalization. The absence had created a strangeness, an incipient, self-fulfilling distance between us that I didn't know how to confront. Much of our time apart had been necessary, dictated by circumstances, but some of it, a lot of it really, had not. I couldn't account for the part of me that remained removed from him. The church was empty. I slipped back into the ambulatory, pausing at the entrance to the tiny chapel. The mermaid chair sat alone, the clerestory window behind it siphoning in a frail, trimmed light. My eyes went instantly to the mermaids on the chair arms. Their greens, reds, and golds were the only brightness in the room. As I'd painted my father, I'd imagined the chair as maternal, the pietà, the immense lap of dying. I'd envisioned the mermaids like exotic midwives on either side of him, their wings conjuring up images of angels carrying him to heaven, their fishtails making me think of night-sea psychopomps bearing him into the dark mother of the ocean. I'd imagined them singing eerie, plaintive songs, crying, not the fake pebbles in the boxes in Cat's shop, but real tears. I'd thought that when I actually saw the chair, I would be weighed under by all this, but what I felt was the most extraordinary lightness. I went and sat down. Leaning my head against the twisting Celtic knot, I let my hands hold on to the mermaid's backs. What came first, to my mind, was the time I'd spent as a child, scattering rose petals around the island as if they were my father's ashes. How I'd especially heap them here, on the seat of the mermaid chair. I wondered if I could possibly have recognized the residue his death left behind, the concentration of goodbyes. Sitting there, I understood so little, and yet much more than I had before. My father had died here, but in a way, I had too. When I'd sat in the chair all those weeks ago, I'd given myself over to loving wit, abandoning my old life. I had begun then to die away. I sensed that Wit had come into the chapel even before I saw him. He called my name. Jesse? He was wearing his robe and his cross. As he walked toward me, I stood up. The knocking started inside my chest. How's Nell? He asked. Much better. She's out of the hospital. His face was pinched, and I knew in a way I can't explain that he possessed the same removed piece inside that I did. I'm glad, he said. Yes, me too. I felt the moat widening and thought how like detachment the sounds between us were. He seemed to be waiting for me to say something. Father Sebastian told me you wanted to see me, he said, the formality in his voice unmistakable. My mouth opened in surprise, but I didn't. Realizing how that must sound, I added, I mean, I'm happy to see you, but I didn't tell him that. Wit frowned. A while ago, when I bumped into him, he made it perfectly clear to me that he knew about us. He was very pointed about it. I felt awkward saying the word us. I'm afraid Sebastian has a nasty habit of reading my journal. But that's inexcusable. The light flickered in the room. I remembered how it had played on his face when he slept, how he'd washed my feet in creek water. I did not understand the mystifying place where our intimacy had flowed back into reserve. You know, I wasn't sure until now that he'd actually read it, he said. I only suspected. I had the feeling when Sebastian was talking to me that he was really asking me to leave you alone, without really saying it. I can only imagine how hard he's made it for you. You would think so, but the truth is, he's been kinder to me since then, like he wanted me to really do what's best. He told me I should ask myself why I came here, what it means to me to be hidden here with God. I guess he got tired of waiting for me to figure it out, he shrugged. Sebastian is a great believer in facing things head on. People don't want to make sacrifices anymore. I think beginnings must have their own endings hidden inside them. Gazing at Wit, I knew that the end had been there the first night we met, back when he'd stood on one side of the monastery wall, and I on the other. The sturdy bricks. Wit knew it. I could tell by the way he'd slid his hands inside the sleeves of his robe, the sadness caked in his eyes. I could see he'd already made the sacrifice. We stood there staring at each other. I wondered if I would have fallen in love with him if he'd been a shoe salesman in Atlanta. It was a bizarre thought, but it seemed somehow the most sensible thought of my life. I doubted I would have. And it was disillusioning to me in the sense of stripping away the last remaining illusions. My falling in love with him had had everything to do with his monkness, his loyalty to what lay deep within him, the self-containment of his solitude, that desire to be transformed. What I'd loved in him most was my own aliveness, his ability to give me back to myself. It felt cruel and astonishing to realize that our relationship had never belonged out there in the world, in a real house where you wash socks and slice onions. It belonged in the shadowed linings of the soul. I had come to the irreducible thing, just as I had with my father, and there was nothing to do but accept, to learn to accept, to lie down every night and accept. I closed my eyes, and it was Hugh I saw. His hands, the hair on his fingers, the band-aids on his thumbs. How real all of that was, how ordinary, how achingly beautiful. I wanted him back. Not like before, but new, all new. I wanted what came after the passion had blown through. Flawed, married love. Wit said, I honestly thought I could go through with this. I wanted to. He shook his head and looked down at a fraying place on the dark carpeted dais. I know. Me too. I didn't want him to say anything more. I wanted the letting go to be silent, to go quickly. Wit nodded. A deep, emphatic nod at something I could not see or hear. He said, I will miss you. I'm sorry. My words cracked as I spoke. I felt I'd been the seducer. I'd sat on the sea rocks like one of Homer's sirens and lured him. Even though he was ending it as much as I felt I was really the betrayer. That I'd betrayed my confessions of love to him. My promise of anniversaries. I don't want you to be sorry, he said. The thing is, I needed. He reached out and touched my face, a place near my jaw. I needed to love you. He could have meant a million things, but what I wanted to believe was that his grief over his wife had deadened his heart, and falling in love with me had resurrected it. I wanted to believe that now he would give his heart back to the monastery. He would go on foraging in the rookery, waking to the sound of frogs in the Bent Island oaks, to the smell of Brother Timothy's bread, catching these little bits of God showing through. It's true of both of us, then. I needed to love you, too. It came out with so much awkwardness, so much ineptness, I felt as if I should go on explaining, but he smiled at me and stepped closer. He said, I told you we'd be damned and saved both, remember? I tried to smile back at him, but it moved painfully on my lips for only a second before evaporating. I reached for him. We held each other without the slightest worry of someone's wandering by. I did not cry, not then. I held him and felt the tide sweep out from the marsh island where we'd made love. I felt a place inside open up, the secret place where I would carry him. And when he'd left, and I was there alone, I felt the pull that must happen inside the egrets when the moon rises in the early dark. that unbearable tug home.
I walked to the boneyard beach and sat on a piece of driftwood that arched out over the sand. I stared at the ocean, where shrimp boats were roosting in thick green waves. The tide was coming in instead of going out, which seemed backward and ironic to me. It seemed everything should be leaving, that there should be stretches and stretches of emptiness. I had lost both of them. Long ago, at the all-girls picnic, when Mother Cat and Hepzibah had walked into the ocean up to their waists, I'd watched them from nearly this same spot. I began to picture them out there, the way they'd giggled as they'd tied their three threads together and thrown them into the waves. Benny and I had wanted to go with them, had begged to go.
"No, this is just for us. Y'all stay back there."
Who would have imagined what would come out of the knots they'd made that night? I tugged off my sandals and rolled my pants as high as I could. Despite the heat, the ocean was still chilled from the winter. I had to go in slowly. When the water swelled above my knees, I stopped and dug in my pocket for the bits of twine I'd gathered off the lawn at the monastery. I wanted to tie a knot that would go on forever, but not with anyone else, with myself. All my life, in nameless, indeterminate ways, I'd tried to complete myself with someone else. First my father, then Hugh, even Whit. And I didn't want that anymore. I wanted to belong to myself. I sorted through the cotton strands, wondering if something in me had known what must be done even as I'd collected them. I stood still with the waves cascading against my thighs, elongating as they flowed beyond me toward the shore. "Jesse, I take you. Jesse." The wind moved sideways past my ears, and I could smell the aloneness in it. For better or for worse. The words rose from my chest and recited themselves in my mind. To love and to cherish. I took the longest string and tied a knot in the center of it. I gazed at it for a minute, then flung it into the ocean at roughly 1 o'clock in the afternoon, May 17th, 1988. And every day of my life since, I return to that insoluble moment with veneration and homage, as if it possesses the weight and ceremony of marriage. Chapter 35. On the last Saturday of May, I stood on the ferry dock with Mother, Cat, Hepzibah, and Benny, all of us lined up at the railing, staring at the wind-chopped bay. White ibis were everywhere. We watched them flying in boomerangs across the bay. My suitcase sat near the gangplank. Cat had brought a basket of purple beach phlox, Carolina jessamine, and pink oleander blossoms, which she intended to toss at the pontoon when it pulled away, like it was the Queen Mary. She poured lemonade from a thermos into little paper cups and handed out Benny wafers. She had been adamant about its being a bon voyage party. Having little appetite, I fed most of my wafers to Max. "Where will you live now?" Benny asked. I thought of my big, drafty house, the turret and the stained glass over the doorways, my studio tucked beneath the roof. "Home," I wanted to tell her. "I'll live at home." But I wasn't sure I could claim it now. "I don't know," I said.
"You can always live here," said Mother.
I looked at the faded orange buoys bobbling on the water, marking the crab traps, and felt the twisted tide deep inside that tethered me to her, to this place. For a moment, I almost believed I could stay. "I'll come back," I said, and abruptly broke down crying, setting off a whole chain reaction. Hepzibah, then Benny, Mother, and finally Cat.
"Well, isn't this fun?" said Cat, doling out paper napkins. "I always said there's nothing like a lot of bawling women to liven up a party."
Having the opportunity, we fled into laughter. I was the last one on the ferry,
I stood at the rail, as Cat had instructed, so I could see the flower toss. It rained oleander, jessamine, and phlox for all of 30 seconds. But I have wrapped and contained the sight very carefully in my mind. I am still able to close my eyes and see the blossoms light on the water like tiny firebirds. I stood there watching after the dock disappeared from sight, and I knew they had all climbed into Cat's golf cart by then. As the island slid into the distance, I stored everything away. The bright expanse of water, the crushing scent of the marsh, the wind soaring in canticles across the bay, and tried not to think what waited for me. Hugh was asleep in his leather chair in the den, wearing black socks, worn down at the heels, a book open across his chest. The portable Jung. He'd forgotten to close the curtains, and the windows behind him blazed with darkness and lamplight. I stood, unmoving, startled by the sight of him, a kind of fluttering in my stomach. My flight had been delayed from Charleston to Atlanta because of thunderstorms, and it was late, close to midnight. I had not told him I was coming. Part of it was pure, cowardly fear, but it was also the hope that I might catch him off guard, and in those one or two moments he would forget what I'd done, and his heart would fill with so much love it would override every justified reason to send me away. That was my foolish, unreasoned hope. I'd let myself in with the key we kept hidden under the flagstone at the rear of the house, leaving my suitcase in the foyer beside the front door. Noticing the light in the den, I thought only that Hugh had forgotten to turn it out when he went to bed. And here he was. For whole minutes I stood there, listening to the puffing noise he made with his mouth when he slept. Rhythmic, sonorous, filled with the rush of years. His arm dangled over the side of the chair. The little bracelet Dee had made was still on his wrist. Outside there was thunder far away. Hugh. I thought of a long time ago, the year before Dee was born. We'd gone hiking in the Pisgah National Forest up in the Blue Ridge Mountains and come upon a waterfall. It dropped 20 or 30 feet from an overhang of rocks, and we'd stood a moment staring up at the plunging water, the way it flashed and held the sun, hundreds of tiny, iridescent rainbows fluttering out of it like a swarm of dragonflies. We'd yanked off our clothes, tossing them on rocks and lady ferns. It was hot, the deep of August, and the water still had the memory of snow in it. Holding hands, we picked our way over mossy stones until we stood beneath the overhang with the water crashing down in front of us. The spray was like a driving rain, the sound deafening. Hugh smoothed my wet hair behind my ears and kissed my shoulders and breasts. We made love, pressed against the cliff face. For weeks I felt the water hitting the earth inside my body. Watching him sleep now, I wanted to pull him back into that niche of wild rock. I would have been happy just to pull him into the ordinary niche we'd carved out together with little domestic tools for all these years, but I didn't know how to return to either one of those places. How to make them the same place. I felt amazed at the choosing one had to do over and over, a million times daily, choosing love, then choosing it again. How loving and being in love could be so different. Rolling his head to the side, he shifted in the chair. Sometimes I think it was my remembering that woke him, that the waterfall spilled out of my mind and caused him to open his eyes. He gazed at me with sleep and confusion. "You're here," he said. Not to me, I realized, but to himself. I smiled at him, but I didn't say anything, unable to scrape my voice up out of my throat. He stood, he lifted his shoulders. I don't think he knew what to feel any more than what to say. He stood in his stocking feet and stared at me. A private, unreadable expression on his face. A car went by out on the street, the motor gunning and falling away. When he spoke, the words sounded curled up and wounded. "What are you doing here?"
I think now of the 10,000 things I could have said to him, whether it would have made any difference if I'd gone down on my knees and canted all my transgressions.
I brought you something, I answered, and raising my hand, as if motioning him to wait, I went to the foyer for my pocketbook. I returned, digging through it. Unzipping my coin purse, I took out his wedding ring. You left this on Egret Island, I said, and held the ring out to him, grasping it between my right thumb and forefinger, lifting my left hand so he could see I was wearing my ring, too.
Oh, Hugh, I want to come home, I said. I want to be here with you.
He didn't move, didn't reach for the ring.
I'm so sorry, I said. I am so sorry I hurt you.
He still didn't move, and it began to feel as if I were holding the ring across a chasm, that if I dropped it, it would fall through the earth. But I couldn't draw back my hand. It was held by that mysterious quality that appears in cats when they've climbed to the top of the tree, to the end of the limb, and then, seeing with horror where they are, simply refuse to come down. I went on, holding the ring out to him.
Take it, please, take it. Hoping so hard, I pinched the imprint of the ring into the pads of my fingers.
He stepped backward, before turning, and left the room. When he'd gone, I set the ring on the table beside his chair. I set it beneath the lamp, which I could not bear to switch off. I slept in the guest room, or to be accurate, I lay awake in the guest room. As atonement, I kept forcing myself to see him in that moment as he turned to leave, his profile against the gleaming windows. The hardness he felt toward me had risen to his face and tensed in his cheek. Forgiveness was so much harder than being remorseful. I couldn't imagine the terrible surrender it would take. It rained much of the night, coming down in great black wheels and shaking the trees. I saw dawn push at the window before I finally fell asleep and woke not long afterward to the aroma of sausage and eggs, to the overwhelming smell of Hugh cooking. There are things without explanation, moments when life will become arranged in such odd ways that you imagine a whole vocabulary of meaning inside them. The breakfast smell struck me like that. That was where our marriage had left off that day back in February. February 17th, Ash Wednesday, the day of ashes and endings. Hugh had cooked breakfast, sausage and eggs. It had been the final thing before I'd left, the benediction. I went downstairs. Hugh stood at the stove holding a spatula. The frying pan was crackling furiously. He'd set two plates on the breakfast bar. Hungry? He said. I wasn't at all, but knowing his abiding faith in the power of such breakfasts, I nodded and smiled at him, sensing the tremor of some quiet new rhythm wanting to establish itself. I climbed onto the bar chair. He spooned half of a vegetable omelet onto my plate. Sausage links, a buttered English muffin.
There you go, he said.
He paused, and I felt him just behind me, breathing in an uneven way. I stared into my plate, wanting to look around at him, but afraid I would ruin whatever was about to happen. The moment seemed to hang in the air, revolving, deliberate, like a bit of glass lifted to the sun and turned slowly to refract the light. Suddenly, he laid his hand on my arm. I sat still as he slid it slowly up to my shoulder and back down. I missed you, he said, leaning close to my ear. I clutched his hand almost fiercely, pulling his fingers to my face, touching them with my lips. After a moment, he gently pulled them away and put the other half of the omelet on his plate. We sat in our kitchen and ate. Through the windows I could see the washed world, the trees and the grass and the shrubs silvered with raindrops.
There would be no grand absolution, only forgiveness meted out in these precious sips. It would well up from Hugh's heart in spoonfuls, and he would feed it to me. And it would be enough.
Epilogue. As the ferry nudges against the dock on Egret Island, the captain blows his horn a second time, and I go out to the railing. I remember the flowers spilling into the water as the boat pulled away last May. The sad little bon voyage party. It seems now like a piece of history starting to sift into dust, and at the same time, as if I've only just been here, as if the petals will still be floating on the water. It is February now. The marshlands are floods of golden yellow. The color settles on me like the heat and light of the sun. The island will always be the fixed point of the migrating world. Out there on the dock, Max is barking. I think of the mermaids hanging from the ceiling in Cat's shop, the egrets flying above Caw Caw Creek, the bare rose bushes in the monastery garden. I picture the mermaid chair alone in the chapel. The whole island rises up to me, and I have a moment when I honestly don't know if I can step off the boat. I stand there and let it pass, knowing it will pass. All things do. When I told Hugh I needed to come and see Mother to be here on Ash Wednesday, he said, "Of course." Then, a moment later, "Is it just your mother you're going to see?" Not that often, but once in a while, the sorrow and mistrust will form across his eyes. His face will close in, and he will be gone. His mind and body will still be there, of course, but his heart, his spirit even, will go to the outer banks of our marriage and camp. A day or two later, he will be back. I will find him cooking breakfast, whistling, bearing more forgiveness. Each day, we pick our way through unfamiliar terrain. Hugh and I did not resume our old marriage. That was never what I wanted, and it was not what Hugh wanted either. Rather, we laid it aside and began a whole new one. Our love is not the same. It feels both young and old to me. It feels wise, as an old woman is wise after a long life, but also fresh and tender. Something we must cradle and protect. We have become closer in some ways. The pain we experienced weaving tenacious knots of intimacy, but there is a separateness as well. The necessary distances. I have not told him yet about the knot I tied in my thread that day in the ocean. I talked to him instead about the mermaids. They belong to themselves, I told him once, and he frowned in the way he does when weighing something he's unsure of. I know at times he's afraid of the separateness, my independence, this abiding new loyalty I have to myself now. But I believe he will come to love this part of me, just as I do. I tell him, smiling, that it was the mermaids who brought me home. I mean, to the water and the mud and the pull of the tides in my own body. To the solitary island submerged so long in myself, which I desperately needed to find. But I also try to explain they brought me home to him. I'm not sure he understands any more than I do how belonging to myself allows me to belong more truly to him. I just know it's true. No, I am not planning to see him, I said to Hugh that day. You can come with me if you want. We'll both go.
It's okay. You should go by yourself, he said. You need to go back and face the island and be done with it.
Now, stepping onto the island, I feel myself bracing, feel my need to gather everything up so I can finally lay it down. Mother's house has been repainted cobalt blue. It is practically radiating when I arrive, chauffeured by Cat in the golf cart. She lays on the air horn in the front yard, and the rest of them come out onto the porch. Mother, Hepzibah, Benny. Inside, sitting at the kitchen table, I look at them and see how everything continues and equally how it changes.
Mother tells me how Cat takes her across the bay every month to see the doctor, that she is on much less medication now. Her finger is still in the jar of alcohol on her dresser. Last August, she went back to her passion for feeding the monks, abandoning Julia Child for James Beard.
The monks miss Julia's food, she tells me, but they'll get over it.
When I ask Hepzibah about the Grand Gullah tour, she sits straighter in her African print dress and tells me it's listed these days in all the tourist magazines in Charleston, that she may have to offer it every single day by the time summer comes around. Cat surprises me most. She has written up her own booklet to sell along with Dominic's in The Mermaid's Tale, called Island Dog. It's the legendary story of Max meeting the fairy every day with unfailing precision. Shaking her head and causing her precarious hairdo to slide out of its combs, she announces that she and Max will be on television news next week. Benny adds that Max is excited and not at all nervous. They want to talk about my paintings, so I let them. I've lost my shyness about all that. Cat chirps about my diving women's show at the Phoebe Pember Gallery in Charleston last October. I had her to thank for it. She was the one who packed all the paintings I'd left behind and took them to the gallery owner herself.
I knew she would want them, she said.
I hadn't come for the opening. I wasn't ready to come back then, but the Egretiers had gone and stood in for me. I am working now on a series of island landscapes. Once in a while, though, I stop and paint one of my quirky mermaids for Cat, just to make her happy. The last one was of a real mermaid working as a saleswoman inside Cat's own shop. She stands behind the counter selling mermaid trinkets to the tourists, wearing a T-shirt that says, The Mermaid's Tale. When Mother asks about Dee, I don't know how much to say. The truth is that Dee was shaken by what happened between Hugh and me. There was a brief period at the end of last summer when she talked about withdrawing from school, taking a semester off. I think she only wanted to be near us, to protect us somehow, as if she bore some responsibility in it all. We had to sit her down and tell her we would be okay, better than okay, that our problems had had nothing to do with her, only with ourselves. In the end, she'd gone back to Vanderbilt, more serious, more grown up. Despite that, she called before I left home to say she was writing Hugh's birthday song, If Sofas Could Talk. What I tell Mother is that Dee has switched her major from English to pre-med, that she has decided to be a psychiatrist like Hugh. Mother wants to know if Dee's decision has anything to do with what she did to her fingers. No, I say. I think it has more to do with what I did. I laugh. But there's truth in it. The five of us talk all afternoon, till the sky darkens and the palmettos make pronged shadows at the window. As they are leaving, Cat tugs me aside over to a private place in the yard beside the bathtub Mary. She hands me a tan canvas bag, which I recognize instantly. It is the one Wit carried in the John boat on Rookery Rounds.
Dominic brought this to the shop a couple of weeks ago, she says. He asked me to give it to you.
I do not open it then, but wait until Mother is asleep and I am alone in my room. I take everything out and lay it across the bed. Four dried brown apple peels tucked inside a plastic bag. A battered box of mermaid tears. White egret feathers, the turtle skull, my father's pipe. All the things I'd left inside the crab trap in Witt's Hermitage are here. During the past year, not a week had gone by that I didn't think about them, wishing I could have managed to go back for them. Witt's letter is at the bottom of the bag.
Dear Jessie, I am returning your things. I have kept them all this time in my cottage, thinking I would give them to you myself when you return to the island. I didn't want to intrude on your life in Atlanta by sending them in the mail. I felt when you were ready, you would return for them.
I am not here, however, to give them to you in person. I will leave the monastery February 1st. I took solemn vows last August, but, ironically enough, decided at Christmas that I would not stay after all. I want to be in the world again. I understand now that a large part of me is not so much hidden here with God, but hiding. I have decided to take back the hazard of life. I came here wanting God, but, truthfully, I was also looking for some kind of immunity from life. There is none. And, of course, I may find that God is out there, too. Dominic reminded me that God is the one whose center is everywhere and circumference is nowhere. I'll go see if he's right. At first, it was difficult for me to go back to the Hermitage, to remember you there, to realize I would know you only as a memory or a longing. But finally, I'm able to think of our time together without regret. You brought me deeper into life. How could I regret that? I want you to be well. Please, be happy. Your Wit. I sit in my mother's blue house and cry into my hands. When that is done, I close the long year of my life, knowing it will stay with me like the turtle skull worn down by the sea, shining and white-boned. The last thing Hugh said to me when I left was this:
"You are coming back this time, right?"
He was smiling, teasing, wanting to lighten the tension we both felt at my returning. I look toward the window. I want to tell him, "Yes, I'm coming back, Hugh. When I die, it will be your face I see hovering over me, whether in flesh or in memory. Don't you know? What I want is you. What I want is the enduring, the beautiful enduring." Author's note: The Mermaid Chair is a work of fiction. The story, the characters, and the setting come purely from my imagination. I've imagined Egret Island as part of the beautiful necklace of barrier islands along the coast of South Carolina, but you will not find the island on a map. It's not a real place. Nevertheless, it's similar to existing South Carolina islands when it comes to its beach, maritime forest, tidal marshes, estuaries, creeks, birds, and animals. I drew on numerous natural history and nature guidebooks. Todd Ballantyne's Tideland Treasure was particularly useful. All the plants, trees, and flora referred to in the book are real, though I took the liberty of inventing one fictitious plant that you will be able to distinguish in retrospect. I've explored numerous barrier islands in South Carolina, but it was Bull Island, an uninhabited and pristine place that was often in the back of my mind as I wrote. Not only did I position Egret Island geographically where Bull Island is located on South Carolina's coastline, I also borrowed the name of Bull Island's magnificent beach, Boneyard. Saint Eudoria is not a real saint in the Catholic Church, as far as I know, though I based her story on accounts of saints who mutilated their bodies in the pursuit of holiness. The legend of Sedna is a genuine Native American tale from the Inuit people, which has several variations. In recounting the story in the novel, I have attempted to be true to its source. The monastery of St. Sanara is non-existent. In writing about it, I've relied on a list of books too long to enumerate, and on my years of study of contemplative spirituality and the monastic life. The Gullah culture, which is referred to in the novel, is a distinct heritage belonging to African-American descendants of slaves who settled along the southeast coast. The culture contains its own customs, food, art, and language, some of which appear in the novel. The Gullah phrases that I've used are part of the Gullah language still spoken in parts of South Carolina.
I'm grateful to the wonderful book Gullah Cultural Legacies by Emery S. Campbell. This novel began one summer day in 2001 when my friend Sherry Tyree mentioned that she'd seen a mermaid chair during a visit to England. I'm deeply grateful to her for this chance comment, which led me to the chair that sits in St. Sinara Church in the ancient village of Zanor, in the beautiful and magical land of Cornwall. The chair is made from two 15th-century bench ends, one of which is carved with a mysterious mermaid. The carving is associated with the fabled mermaid of Zanor, who fell in love with one of the church's choristers, then lured him into the sea. Little historical information is available about St. Sinara, the saint for whom the Cornish church is named, but I was intrigued by a legend suggesting that before Sinara's conversion, she was a Celtic princess named Asinora. Armed with these two morsels of inspiration, the historical mermaid chair and the bit of lore about Sinara and Asinora, I began to weave my own story. I created a distinctly different mermaid chair for the novel, different in appearance, in history, and in the mythology that surrounds it, though I did use some fragments from the Mermaid of Zanor myth. I am indebted and grateful to St. Sinara Church in Cornwall, for without its famous chair, this novel could not have been written. Finally, I would like to acknowledge two books that became my companions as I immersed myself in the symbolism, mythology, art, and history of mermaids. Sirens by Mary Lau and Mermaids, compiled by Elizabeth Radiseau. This is Eliza Foss. We hope that you've enjoyed this production of The Mermaid Chair by Sue Monk Kidd. This program was executive produced by Patty Peruse and produced and directed by John McElroy. The Mermaid Chair is a production of Penguin Audio. Copyright 2005. All rights reserved.